September 17, 2013 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources. We are on the record. Welcome to everyone. Thank you. It looks like we have a full house here today. Our first order of business is the adoption of committee rules. Members, have you had an opportunity to review these? I suspect if you've been in other committee hearings, they look very familiar. Do we have any questions?
Good afternoon, Chair.
I'm not seeing any. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, Chair Witt, I move that we adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 17, 2013.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Esquivel moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 17, 2013. Discussion on his motion. Seeing none, hearing none. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative
Platt. Excused.
Representative
Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Thompson?
Aye.
Representative
Unger?
Excused.
Representative
Woodson?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Esquivel?
Aye.
And Vice Chair
Frederick?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Chair Witt?
Thank you.
The chair votes aye. Thank you very much. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. Thank you, committee members, very much. And with that, we will move on to our informational meeting. I'm going to open an informational meeting. We're going to have a presentation today on the extreme forest fire season that our state and a number of others have experienced this season. I think we're going to hear that there have been some irregularities, not only in terms of the size of the fires, the number of fires, but perhaps who may be getting the opportunity to pay for the bill. And with that, I'd like to call forward, please, two of our colleagues whose districts have been plagued by fire this season, Senator Bertschinger and Representative Bentz. You come forward, please. Gentlemen, welcome to our committee. We appreciate very much your attending. Yeah, can we get the map up? I jumped the gun. I wanted the department actually to post the map. So if they would do that, thank you very much. Gentlemen, we would like to hear the impacts that forest fires have had on your districts this season.
Cliff, why don't you go first? You had the first fire.
Well, thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee for holding this hearing. I'm, as you well know, my district is partially timbered and a lot more sagebrush. So the fires that affect my district have an impact both on timber communities and then also on grazing communities. And so this year followed last year, and I really have to mention last year because almost a million acres of my 19 million acre district burned up. And so the damage that was done is, I'm talking about sagebrush first, long lasting and could have devastating impacts on all of Eastern Oregon. And again, this will sound familiar because you've heard of the sage grouse bill that you helped get passed. And the challenge there, of course, is with a million acres of habitat being destroyed, it makes the listing of the grouse that much more likely. Mm-hmm. So these fires, one thinks, well, got a fire, everything will come back, and we'll go back to normal. But that's not necessarily going to be the case if, as a result of these fires, so much habitat is destroyed that the result is a listing of the grouse. And so trying to protect these sensitive and critical habitat areas just extraordinarily important. Now, there's been all kinds of challenges in getting that done because my area of the state, District 60, and forgive me, Mr. Chairman, I may not have stated my name, but Cliff Bentz, District 60, is, of course, Mount Hare County, Grant County, Lake County, Harney County and Baker County, and those areas are all sage grouse habitat filled, and are all grazing in some way dependent. And so just figuring out some way of stopping these fires is extremely important, but unfortunately in some cases backfires and other things that have been started to try to put these fires out have had as much impact as the fire itself. And so what I have done in my district in watching last year's fires and again this year's is tried to follow up on the improvement of the processes in trying to fight these fires. And I want to say that the BLM and the Forest Service and all of the folks that work with them have an enormous challenge with the high winds and the increasing fuel loads and the layers of different folks that are fighting these fires. Coordinating a response has been, in many cases, extraordinarily challenging. As a lawyer, this then called many times by ranchers and asked to maybe sue whoever it was that they, there's many people to blame for some of the outcomes. We've had opportunities to look into the causal relationships of how these fires started and then how they were either controlled or not. It's kind of like going back and trying to sort out, I'm sure, a war and trying to figure out why different decisions were made, when and where and how. And of course, very, very challenging to figure out why certain things happen. I will just say that working with the Department of Forestry, Oregon Department of Forestry, and others, they've expressed a huge willingness to try to get better at what they're doing, a willingness to accept the fact that mistakes have been made in many of these fires, and they're trying to do a better job. There's so many causes, and I just want to say just a couple more things about fuel loads. We, in my part of the world, would suggest that we're not doing enough to reduce the amount of fuel that's available for these fires, and as a result, when they burn, they burn with incredibly devastating consequences, incredibly hot, and incredibly damaged to the water, the ground, and everything else. The area from south of Burns down toward Nevada, where I grew up, burned last year. And if you drove through there, you would think you were on Mars. You could, there's nothing. You could count every rock because there was no grass, no brush, no nothing. Just black. And so for not a mile or so, but for hundreds of miles. And the consequences, as I indicated, are devastating to the community and also long-term. One of the problems we have right now is that so much of the money that normally would be used to rehabilitate these parcels is being used to fight these fires. And so once they're over, there's no money left to plant sagebrush or other native grasses because the seed's very expensive and no money. So what do we do? Particularly in light of the fact that if we don't get this habitat back, much more likely the grouse would be listed, and sadly, much more likely those types of listings would further restrict activity in those areas. Mr. Chair, I apologize for the scattered nature of my testimony. I'll just say that if I was in to try to solve this problem, I would try to figure out how we could better coordinate our efforts with the BLM and with Forest Service in trying to prevent fire in the first place, which means trying to reduce those fuel loads, and then secondly, trying to do a better job of figuring out where we're going to get the money to rehabilitate these lands, because it's extraordinarily important that we bring the habitat back to try to reduce the chances of the listing. So there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Happy to talk more, but I should probably go down to my transportation meeting.
Thank you very, very much, Representative Bentz. Do you have time for a question or two, or do you need to run?
No, go ahead.
Are there any members that would have questions for our colleague? Representative Whitsitt, please.
Representative Bentz, I was wondering how would you go about replanting or What kind of a program would you have to replant the native brush and grasses there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Bureau of Land Management has a program for replanting, and probably I hope someone is from that agency to answer that question better than I. I would say one of the things we should be doing is a better job of supporting those who produce sagebrush seed and other natural grass seeds. It's hard to collect sagebrush seed. It's hard to raise it. It's expensive, but we need more of it. And then we also need to figure out some way of making it rain. So once we plant this stuff, it actually grows. But the problem is it's expensive to gather the seed, and it's expensive to then drill it. And then you've got to, of course, make sure you try to protect the land that you've drilled while you wait for it to grow. And so the short answer is I think we need to do a better job in incenting more production of seed. That's where I'd start, because I don't think we have enough of it. And that's, again, something that should be fact-checked with whoever else might testify regarding rehabilitation. And it's one thing to say incent folks, but it's another to find the money to do it. So we ought to be measuring the consequences of not doing the rehabilitation on future economic activity because we failed, and thus we end up with a listing, and then say, hey, maybe we better invest now to try to prevent that from happening later.
Representative Krieger.
Representative, you talked about there not being the money to do the rehabilitation. I look on the west side, a lot of that land is private land, industrial land. That's not an excuse for us. We're going to go in and we're going to harvest it, we're going to salvage it, and we're going to be in there next January planting trees. We're required to do that under the Forest Practices Act. Then we need something for the federal government to be required to at least meet our standards, which now they're not.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just say that I found the BLM to be pretty cooperative in my area, because we all view it as a common challenge. Since we don't log sagebrush, we don't enjoy much value from it other than the environmental value for the grouse and other creatures. But there's also the grazing aspect of it, which is hugely important. But because of the modest amount of range grass that those areas generate, it's not intensive grazing ever. It's you go across it and you're done. I think most would suggest that probably additional grazing would be good for many reasons, reducing fine fuels, for example. But it doesn't generate that much additional revenue to assist in replanting after a fire. And there's really no reason to replant after grazing as there is to replant after logging. So it's kind of two different worlds. And a lot of the senator can better testify as to the forest end of things.
Any additional questions? Representative Benz, thank you very, very much. I certainly appreciate your testimony and your taking time out of your other committee's business to come here and share your story with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be back to talk about Calico when that comes up.
Very good. Thank you. We'll look forward to it. Senator Birdsugar.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Committee, Herman Birdsugar, Senator District 2, which is Grants Pass in northern Jackson County. Before I go into, you know, a little bit what has happened this summer in my district, I think there's something I want to share with the committee is, you know, fire has been part of Oregon since day one, and it will continue to be part of Oregon forever. And we can't change that. But what we can change is how big the fires get. And we can do that well before the fire ever starts. And I think that's something that we have to, as legislatures, work on in the future, and that's forest health. So you'll hear a testimony from ODF today, and they're going to go into a lot of detail of what happened, but they'll talk about, Mr. Medina will talk about the ECR being very high that day, which the ECR is a way we measure British thermal units for a square foot. So to simplify it for legislature, in your fireplace, if you put a couple pieces of firewood in your fireplace, you have a nice little fire. But if you dump a whole wheelbarrow of firewood in your fireplace, what's going to happen? And that's what has happened in Oregon forests now. But anyways, going on to July, what happened in our district? Dry lightning storm came through, kind of caught us off guard. It was a interesting weather created dry lightning storm, and I mean dry. In my 30-some years of fighting fire, I don't remember one quite this dry. I don't think there was a drop of rain out of it. And if you look at the fire starts, that dry lightning storm came out of Northern California and just did a straight line straight up north through Oregon, and wherever it went, we had a fire. And I don't know the exact starts in Josephine County. I think ODF will tell you that, but it was somewhere around 25. And Douglas County, I think, was pushing 50. I don't know, and those were active fires, were they? When that lightning hit, you had a fire. And because it was dry lightning, and you had no humidity and no moisture with it, it was a fire. It wasn't just a smoldering snag or something. It was a fire. And so out of all those starts, we wound up with a handful that we just couldn't quite get a rope around, you know. You only have so many people, and I don't know how many are familiar with Southern Oregon, but it's pretty vertical. And you got to walk to these fires. It's not a road to every single one of them. And the difference between the dry lightning and a wet lightning strike is we had active fire behavior right out of the gate on all these fires. So that means you had to have manpower, had to get a line around it. It wasn't just some old snag on fire you could fall and put out with a bucket of water. So we really had some problems. You know, ODF got on it. They were on those things about 4 o'clock in the morning, just an hour after that lightning storm went through. And a few months later, we're what, $120 million into this thing? So it's been one of those years. The negative effects outside of losing all that timber, the negative effects of the community are unbelievable. First of all, we had the smoke. We had an inversion layer. That's another reason I might want to point out that I don't think it's talked about. We had air assets, but we couldn't use them at times because of the inversion of the smoke. And so that made things a little tougher. And that was a little unusual, too. We'll usually be able to use our air assets right out of the gate a little more. But so anyways, back to the negative effects on the community. First, we have the smoke. The smoke in Grants Pass, and I think Medford, too, was just unbelievable, where you couldn't see across the street. So anybody that had any respiratory problems and stuff really had some problems. Also, on our tourist industry, nobody wanted to hang around. We had to close the Rogue River to the rafting. So, you know, we had a lot of dollars left, you know, and I don't know if you've been paying attention, but Josephine County's got some financial problems. So when we start losing our tourism, too, I mean, that just makes things worse. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's September. We still have one fire that we're still dealing with in Josephine County. That's it's all on BLM ground. That's the big windy fire. And we'll probably be dealing with that particular fire until the first significant rain. So I think the worst is behind us, but we still have a month of fire season, really. Really, when you look at where we are, we're middle of September, it's very easy to get into the middle of October or even towards November in fire season. So, you know, we can keep spending millions and millions of dollars putting these fires out, or we can start using our heads and start thinking about trying to keep these fires smaller. And how we do that is we make sure we have the manpower, and we also make sure that we start managing these forests and try to get that, I call it tons per acre. It's just a mathematical equation. You know, and we need to start, as a body, we need to start addressing this and working with our federal partners to address that on the federal lands, too. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you very, very much. Questions for the good senator?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Esquivel, please.
Yeah, I don't have a question, but I do want to address that I've been in Medford all my life, and that's the first time I'd ever seen smoke. When you looked across your yard, it was bluish tinge to it. And the other thing that was unbelievable is how long it lasted. It lasted, I think, a couple of weeks. we were having that inversion. But to show you how the senator is talking about fire season isn't over, last week Medford had 102, 102, 98, 97. So, it's, and today it's pouring rain. So that's a good thing. But it can happen at any time, and it's very devastating to not only the economy, but more importantly, I don't understand, I guess, why we don't take care of the forest a little better than we do. I just don't understand. It doesn't even make sense. But well, that's a different issue.
Yeah, some people don't want us. They
well, like the heads-off
approach, and the results are not too good at times.
Can we put up the photo that that we have to kind of give the visual on how thick that smoke can get sometimes?
Well,
Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I heard the presentation from the Department of Forestry earlier. I'd actually like them to come up here sooner rather than later, because I don't necessarily agree with your assessment, Senator, that we're not doing a good job with our department and our forest fire, our current forest fire practices. I actually, my understanding is that Oregon is the envy of the country when it comes to
I'm saying the opposite. You misread me. Yeah, I'm saying the opposite.
They're
doing an absolutely fabulous job. What I'm saying is the only thing that we can do different as a legislature is to get these fires smaller, is reducing the fuel available for the fires. That has nothing to do with their firefighting ability. That has something to do with our ability to have a healthy forest.
Right.
Okay.
I disagree on that part as well. I actually think that there are lots of people, including the Department of Forestry, who are working hard to make sure that we have healthy forests, and I think they do a pretty good job. And I don't think that the fires this year, just like the lack of fires over the last decade, really, probably if you asked, I think the experts, they would tell you that there's sure lots of different things that go into the impacts of having lots of forest fires, but forest health and the lack thereof this year, it doesn't happen one year and didn't happen the year before. So I just don't think it's as simple as forest health in the way that you describe. And I would appreciate if we can maybe get the department up here to talk a little more.
They'll be coming up. And I think one of the things, Representative Unger, that we're going to see is you make the point that our state does a good job in trying to reduce that fuel load. And I think you're going to see more than likely a difference between fire that occurs on some forest land ownerships versus others. So,
sure.
Yeah, but I want to be perfectly clear. I think the department, we are fortunate to have a department that can do the job they do with the money they have to do it with. They do a great job. They got some good folks. You look at some of the other states, and I work in a lot of different states. We're getting off really good in the state of Oregon. So
yeah,
let's make sure that's clear.
I just want to point out that this fire here, my son and I were camped on a rim in the Stinking Water Mountains, and a lightning strike came through the night before. And just like the senator said, when that lightning hit, that fire just blew up. And we had no ability to cell phones or anything else. And this was the following day, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon in mid-August. And the lighting in the room is such you can't see it really well, but that landscape is dark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's how thick that smoke was. And that fire is a mile and a half away right there. So with that, kind of gives us the visual.
Yeah, and Representative Esquivel, you're right. We had some people that would call in and thought their house was on fire, because when they looked across their living room, the smoke that was inside the house, they thought their house was on. I mean, that's how bad the smoke was. And okay.
All right.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Senator. Certainly appreciate your taking your time to come and share the story with us. All right, with that, I'd like to call up, please, Doug Decker, Nancy Hirsch, and Travis Medina. And before they start their testimony, I would like to recognize our committee's new vice chair, Representative Frederick. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very excited, frankly, to be here. This is a committee assignment that I asked for at the beginning of the last session, and I'm just really happy, at the beginning of the long session, and I'm just happy to get a chance to be part of this.
And I think you have some long-standing interests in natural resources that will serve you well here in this committee. We're fortunate to have you.
So I'm looking forward to it quite a bit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Vice Chair Escavel and Frederick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. I'm joined here by the Chief of our Fire Protection Division, Nancy Hirsch, as well as the Deputy Chief of our Fire Protection Division, Travis Medina. Appreciated the conversation that has preceded us, and we will be touching directly into those themes of fuels management, costs, as well as ownership. I think land ownership is a key variable here, and I know that we'll be talking about that here today. So we've been before you before, kind of describing the mission of the Department of Forestry. Fire is at the heart of what we do. We protect 16 million acres of forest from fire in Oregon, all private forest land, all BLM land in western Oregon, as well as state forest land. You know, if you look at the overall ownership picture of Oregon's forests, about 60% of Oregon's forests are owned by the federal government. We protect a portion of those under contract and have for decades, the BLM lands in western Oregon. So that's our business. We've been in that business since 1911. We basically double the number of employees we have in the department during the summer, making us Oregon's biggest fire department. Another cornerstone for us in our agency has to do with our working relationships with our fire partners. First and foremost, the forest landowner community is huge. You'll be hearing about that today. The Office of State Fire Marshal and the structural fire community, the Federal Fire Agency, certainly, Oregon's Emergency Management Office, the Oregon National Guard. We have a very capable, complete and coordinated fire protection system, and everybody in that system had an opportunity to get their hands involved in the action this summer. So we're before you today to give you a status report. We're going to be talking about the 2013 fire season, and it is still underway statewide, as has been observed. It's historic. This is going to be a fire season that we're going to talk about for a long time. I've been with the agency for 26 years, and by all measures that I'm familiar with, I've never seen a fire season like this. Talking with colleagues and predecessors, they recognize this truly is a historic fire season. 116,000 acres burned on state protected land. We haven't seen that since 1951. 1951 was the fourth in the series of the four big Tillamook fires. Costs. We're at about $120 million of costs. We're going to talk in detail about that here in just a few moments. It's the most expensive fire season we've ever seen in Oregon. It's also been a time of excruciating loss. We've had four firefighters here in Oregon who've died in the line of duty. Putting it on the books as one of the deadliest fire seasons on record. In addition to the human toll and the costs, the losses have been significant. And I know you're going to be hearing from one of our landowners here in a little bit who's going to put some very good perspective on that. There's really been untold. We don't have a way to count those losses at this point, as well as resource losses in terms of timber and other values. These have, this last couple of months, and will continue to have for decades, an impact on these forest landowners. We've experienced significant tourism losses, as Senator Berchiger has mentioned, particularly in the Rogue River, which was shut down for 10 days during the worst of the big windy fire. The smoke impacts have been significant. I had a couple emails from some of our board members during the worst of the fires in Medford, and definitely impacted southern Oregon and elsewhere. So by every measure, this is a fire season that we're going to be referring to for many years. So Travis and Nancy, you're going to give us kind of a look at how fire season shaped up, how we've responded, and what the pathway looks like ahead in terms of taking stock of the loss as well as paying for the costs. So, Travis, you want to take it away?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Witt, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Travis Medina, and I'm the Deputy Chief of Fire for the Department of Forestry located here in Salem. What we have is a PowerPoint presentation put together to kind of walk through the 2013 fire season, help set the stage. And then I'll turn it over to Nancy, and she'll finish off. First, to paint the context going into the 2013
2013 fire season. This chart shows severity and potential severity of fire season, and early on predictions existed around a very active fire season and potentially extreme fire season in July and August for Oregon. This is a combination of temperature, moisture, fuels, and drought that we've seen over the last few years. Again, it helps paint that picture of potentially difficult and challenging situations and fire seasons ahead, and as we know now, that absolutely played out to be 100% true. So it really starts with May and June, and we consider those kind of the first two chapters of the 2013 season. And as we look at those, we had numerous 200-plus acre fires in southern Oregon along with Douglas Forest Protective Association. That was really a preview of what was going to come as we got into late July and into August. This is a picture from Douglas Forest Protective Association, and for May, that's some extremely active fire behavior. And again, as we moved into July and August, conditions only worsened across the state. So as we got into July and these fire activity increased and conditions worsened, especially in central Oregon, down in Douglas, and along with southwest Oregon, on July 14th, we sent our first incident management team of the year over to just outside of Prineville to the Box Springs fire. On July 20th, a 500-acre fire occurred down in southern Oregon outside of the town of Williams, the Pacifica fire, which required significant evacuations. Again, all signs pointing to an extreme fire year in 2013. Said in numerous hearings, and as I look at that, a picture says a thousand words in my mind. And if you look at that picture, that's a picture of a 300-plus foot fire whirl from one of the large fires this summer. And truly, as you look at that, the sheer energy combustion is absolutely sobering. That is absolutely devastating. It can throw spot fires numerous miles. And those were the types of conditions that set up in the 2013 fire season. Fire behavior like this we absolutely do not see every year and is truly a testament to what the conditions were like in 2013. So as we set the stage, July 26th, a unique and rare weather event occurred that Senator Birchtigger talked a little bit about, and it produced a very dry, efficient, and an effective lightning storm. And those are two words you don't want to have when you talk about lightning storms. The storm was extremely dry, not a drop of rain. Everywhere a lightning strike hit, a fire occurred. That ultimately led to about 80 fires across our southern Oregon district and along with Douglas Forest Protection Association. That lightning storm really shaped what the next 2 months would look like for Oregon's fire season. While only a few of those fires became large, and we'll talk about those in a minute, and made the headlines, what didn't make the news was the hundreds upon hundreds of other fires that were caught at initial attack before they grew to 10 acres. Due to the extreme fuels and weather, stopping this many fires and only having a few become large is truly a testament to the young men and women that were out there, along with the work of our cooperators and contractors and obviously our landowner partners. Senator Birchtigger introduced the topic of energy release component. This is a tool we use significantly during the fire season. And what this does is it really measures the amount of moisture in the live and dead fuels. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if you would sum up what this chart shows, is how readily and how hot a fire will burn. So it paints a very good picture of what the fuel conditions are on the landscape. So as you look at this, the red line is the 2013 fire season. And you can see we've done a lot of work over the last few years around when we cross critical thresholds and are at risk for large fire. As you cross that red line in the middle, just below 60, because of a lot of work we've done, have shown that there's significant risk for large fire. As you can see around July 26th, that red line with the call-out bullet there, when that lightning event occurred, we were setting all-time records based off the last 10 years for the highest ERC values within southwest Oregon. Again, this just paints the picture that fuels were absolutely critical and susceptible to large fire growth, and all you needed was a lightning start, and that's what occurred on July 26th. So what emerged out of that were five significant fires or complexes of fires on ODF protection or threatening ODF protection. The first was the Douglas Complex, and it was turned into two significant fires, Rabbit Mountain along with the Dad's Creek Fire. The second was the Big Windy Complex. The third was the Brimstone Fire. The fourth was the Whiskey Complex, and the fifth was Labrador. This picture, the top picture there, is taken from one of the heavy air tankers that we fund through the special purpose appropriation along with our landowner partners now after the Wildfire Protection Act, and looking at the Rabbit Mountain and Dad's Creek Fire at their infancy stage. Ultimately, both of these fires ended up in about the 25,000-acre range. At one point, the Douglas Complex had more than 3,000 personnel on it. That's just this incident alone. 3,000 folks is more than double what the entire Department of Forestry is, our entire staff, including all of our seasonal firefighters. If you took one step back and looked at the theater of operations down in southern Oregon at the peak, there were more than 6,000 people working fires down there. That's quadruple what the Department of Forestry's total staff was. That is a significant amount of folks working on fires. The last kind of informational piece around the Douglas Complex is that it was the number one fire in the nation for 11 straight days. And in the fire business, being number one is not always good. That means you have the largest, most complex fire across the nation. However, it does allow resources to flow in, and that's what happened on the Douglas Complex. You've seen this map earlier. This is a vicinity map, and so I won't spend much time on it. It just really paints the picture of what that Southern Oregon Theater of Operations looked like. You can see the significant amount of fire on the landscape. If you were to draw a circle around that, that's a 30-mile circle. So those fires were extremely close, and the work that needed to occur to hold those fires there was extremely significant. If you were to just draw that a circle around that, that would have been hundreds and hundreds of more thousand acres that would have burned. The other piece that I'd touch on with this slide is it highlights the BLM West Side contract that we have. You can see the checkerboard ONC lands there. Those are the peach-colored lands, and the white are the private. So that highlights what the ownership looks like in Southern Oregon. My favorite picture of the 2013 fire season, and again, this is because this was a wildfire protection resource that was added. And really, as you look at the next chapter, it started in August with the east side having two significant fires. At one point in time, there were 7 days of predicted lightning, which actually occurred on the east side, which eventually led to two significant fires, the first being the Grant County complex outside of John Day, the second being the government flats fire outside of the Dalles. Collectively, those burned 25,000 acres. While large fires have dominated the headlines, over 1,000 fires have been stopped at initial attack in under 10 acres. There's been numerous success stories out of the 2013 fire season because of aggressive initial attack, because of our landowner partners, and also through the use of the severity resources. This ultimately, through the use of those severity resources, ultimately ends up saving millions, and that doesn't even account for the loss of environmental resources. This picture is one of those single-engine air tankers that was added on this year because of the WPA, and it actually stopped this fire before it was large and costly. The Wildfire Protection Act has been huge, and appreciate this committee's support in the last legislative session over that. And as you'll remember again, the severity program more than doubled with the landowners adding dollars through the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund into severity. That matched with the general fund and the special purpose appropriation allowed us to bring on some additional resources. Our normal complement is two heavy air tankers and three helicopters that we can pre-position around the state. With the Wildfire Protection Act, we were able to add two additional helicopters, Type 2 helicopters, an additional Type 3 helicopter, and an aerial detection platform, along with these two aircraft in that top picture, which are single-engine air tankers available to drop 800 gallons of retardant out of each of those. Due to the severity of the fire season and the Wildfire Protection Act, we were able to add additional resources. At one point, we added a third heavy large air tanker. Those can drop 3,000 gallons of retardant, along with a Type 1 helicopter, and there are numerous success stories around the state that those resources were part of. In total, the severity resources that we added in the 2013 fire season have flown more than 1,000 hours. That is a very significant number of hours flown on aircraft. We've dropped 352 loads of retardant. That's over 850,000 gallons of retardant. And helicopters have delivered more than 1 million gallons of water to fires through buckets. I just would like to underscore those numbers. That's more than almost 2 million gallons of aerial delivered fire and water this season, and that's significant and has been absolutely critical in reducing cost, even during a very costly fire season. And with that, Chair, I'll turn it over to Nancy for the next set.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Travis. Good afternoon, Chair Witt, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch. I'm the Fire Protection Division Chief for the Oregon Department of Forestry. And I'm going to kind of wrap this piece up by talking a little bit about some of our preliminary statistics, costs, talk a little bit about the losses, and sum up at the end here with some themes. So I think Travis has got the next slide. You can see this slide shows lightning in the Pacific Northwest essentially since 2001 and goes through 2013. 2013, you can see that there is more than double the 10-year average. So we ended up with over 150,000 lightning strikes that occurred this year to date. Now, again, a few catastrophic fires have captured everyone's attention. Over 1,000 of these wildfires have been put out at less than 10 acres. And that's during what I would call a very challenging year, and especially one that has seen this kind of lightning activity where at multiple times throughout the state you have a complete drawdown of the local resources. So speaks volumes to really the frontline folks out there day in and day out keeping as many fires as we have small this season. So I mentioned total fires, 1,083 to date. You've heard the number, close to 117,000 acres burned. Again, to note this season, 483 have been lightning caused, and that's about 45% of the total fires. Now that's compared to the past or the past decade, we typically see about a third, 30 plus percent of our fires started by lightning. So there's definitely a translation here in terms of the amount of lightning, and then very specifically the dry lightning event on July 26th. This slide, the red line on the right-hand side, connects to about 117,000 acres, so the acres are there on the right. The blue bar, which stands out unfortunately very well for the 2013 fire season, connects to the dollar amounts on the left-hand side. That blue bar right there shows about 110 million. We have not quite updated that chart to reflect the most recent data, which others have talked about here. We are at a gross large fire cost number of about $120 million. You can see the significance in comparison to previous fire seasons. Key to note here is this is gross, and it does not account for yet basically reimbursements that we anticipate from certain fires that qualified under a federal management assistance grant, FEMA, basically. And I'm going to talk more about that as we move into the next slide. So many of you have seen this slide before. This chart essentially shows how Oregon annually prepares to pay for large fires. I call it basically an overview of the fire funding policy framework. Now, most fires, as we've talked about here today, are caught at the base level of protection, and that's the fire department. Those are the 600 seasonals and the permanent staff that we have in play, combined with the statewide severity resources, which this year, as you can see, as Travis has pointed out, as a result of the Wildfire Protection Act, we were able to bring in new dollars coming from the landowners through the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, a new $3 million. Because we knew early, based on the forecast for this fire season, as soon as that bill passed and was signed by the governor, we had resources in play just shortly after July 8th when that bill was signed. So I want to say thank you all for that. So again, what's beyond there then is really, again, this large fire funding policy framework. And so annually, the State Forester, in conjunction with the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, purchases a catastrophic fire insurance policy. The policy is for $25 million this year as a result of the Wildfire Protection Act. It's a $20 million deductible. We've completely gone through the deductible, and obviously you can see there we are through the insurance policy. The general fund is responsible for $10 million of the deductible, as well as the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, the other $10 million. Just to note, that $10 million is not a part of the department's budget. So beyond that, again, I want to roll back to the $120 million gross number that I mentioned. What we take from there are estimates, which are of about 45 million dollar insurance policy, and then are also estimating another $43 million from FEMA, and then another $2.3 million from the Forest Service in fire cost recovery. What that leaves in terms of what's left on the table to date is an additional $28 million. That $28 million is a conversation that we basically start here today, and as a part of our request today, we'll be wanting to come back and further that conversation as we refine those costs for November, and then likely needing to make an ask to the legislature in the February session.
I just want to point out, you've seen this before when we've talked about the Wildfire Protection Act. Just for context, amongst my colleagues, the Western State Foresters, having something like this in place is very desirable. We're the only state that has an insurance policy like this and has the sophistication of a system ready to pay for large fires. The federal government has tried through something called the Flame Act to have a funding basis in place to help fund large fires on federal forest land. They've never been able to fund that. And so just wanted to recognize for context, this system that we have that you've helped create through the Wildfire Protection Act with our partners is kind of the envy of certainly of Western State Foresters, and it has worked very well this season.
All right.
We got a couple more slides here. Okay. Moving to the next slide, we're going to touch on losses here. Obviously, with large fires come significant devastating losses, particularly for landowners as well as the public. The state's fire protection system, Doug talked about earlier, protects over 16 million acres, has an estimated value of $20 billion. What landowners have lost are not only the investment they made to get these trees up and growing to where you see here, but they've also lost the time now that they've been burned. And thirdly, they have to come to the table to reinvest, as Representative Crager here has pointed out very early in the conversation today, and must make those reinvestments in order to keep Oregon's forest green and working. The losses are significant, as others have described, in terms of the local communities. Air quality, I don't have the data from Medford, but I did note Grants Pass was in, air quality was at anywhere from unhealthy, very unhealthy, to hazardous for over a month down there in southern Oregon. You know, I just would also say that I was out on the Douglas Complex, which is where these photos were taken last week, with a couple of the industrial landowners. One of them here today will provide comments. But I'd certainly encourage you. Oftentimes, wildfires, when the flames are roaring, is when they get the attention. But these fires this year and the devastating losses definitely require some attention. So lastly, our partnerships. Really, Doug touched on this early. I would just like to add a couple comments augmenting, you know, what has been said earlier. Landowners are critical to how we get our work done. Day in and day out, preseason, regular season, they bring equipment, personnel, subject matter expertise to the table. Oftentimes, this as in kind. The National Guard was mobilized twice this year, bringing not only aviation assets but ground troops, particularly for traffic point control points. The State Fire Marshal's Office was mobilized on four different occasions to ensure that structures and communities were protected. So with that, I'm going to move on, as Doug has mentioned, a number of other pieces. What's ahead for fire season? Well, as you can see, the conditions have moderated over the past week, and appears that a more normal late summer fall pattern is setting up. We're definitely not out of the woods. In my mind, an east wind event can change things overnight, so until we see serious fall rains, we're not out of the woods. Lastly, themes, you've heard it, weather, fuel, and specifically lightning. We weren't able to do this job as well as we did this season without all of our landowner partners and the wide variety of partner cooperators. Large fires have made the headlines, but again, over 1,000 fires have been stopped at initial attack. Severity has been critical, and the extra resources this year that were brought to bear as a result of the Wildfire Protection Act have been a great success. The bottom line for the 2013 fire season, it's been a challenge. It's been historic. And lastly, I would just want to leave with you, we often talk about the fire protection system as being complete and coordinated, and where do we get that? We get that exactly and specifically out of Oregon revised statutes under your leadership. I want to say that that's appreciated. The system and the framework was there to adapt and grow and or ramp up the system as was necessary this season. We would prefer to not have to use all the mechanisms that are there, but we did have to this year, and I want to just really say thank you to each and every one of you for your support and giving us a clear mission. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for our panel. Representative Whitsitt, please.
You mentioned, I think, $20 billion worth of trees that Oregon has. Was that the correct number, that you estimated the resource at $20 billion? Do you base that on harvestable, certain size trees, or how did you come up to that number?
Chair Witt, Representative Witt, the number was actually an estimated $60 billion on the 16 million acres that ODF has fire protection responsibility on. And that is an estimate that's provided from our forest economists. And it definitely includes primarily the timber values, but it does also include some infrastructure values.
Could I get a copy of
that report? That would, I think, serve the entire committee well, so thank you for making that request. Additional questions?
I'm concerned about our state's ability to pay the $28 million, and the meter continues to run. We don't know for how high that number may get. Can you give us some insight as to the department's plans for dealing with that?
Sure. Chair Witt, so the firefight was the big part of the story this summer. The big part of the story right now for us is paying the bills.
Yeah.
And so we actually have payment teams that are in the process right now of making sure that we get our bills paid in a timely manner. Something that we've done in the past that we're doing again this year, we've actually taken out a line of credit to help us cover the cash flow costs during the time it takes for us to get payments back from FEMA and from the federal government, from the BLM, from the Forest Service. Ultimately, as we kind of zero that out and figure out what is left at the end of the day, that estimate somewhere between $25 and $30 million looks like that's going to be kind of uncovered costs. And it's those costs that we will be bringing back before the February session to kind of settle out where those are going to come from, likely falling on the general fund.
And you mentioned that while we're waiting for others to pony up their fair share, the map that we saw that that described where those fires were located, can we characterize the ownership of those lands?
Sure. So these lands, the fires, these were all lightning related fires.
Mm-hmm.
They started predominantly on that mix of checkerboard that represents Bureau of Land Management lands in Western Oregon. You can see the Big Windy Fire. That is one of the few large concentrated blocks of continuous BLM ownership in Western Oregon. So that's where the Big Windy started. The other fires really involved just a kind of a mosaic of private forest land and BLM land.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just that mix. And that's one of the reasons that we have had a contract for protecting those lands for the last 60 years. It's because it really makes sense to have a single organization providing fire protection in a jurisdictionally complicated landscape that the map represents.
And would we expect then, Doug, that
the federal government would reimburse us for the full cost of what it took to suppress those fires.
We have a protection contract with the Bureau of Land Management that they pay for annually, and that's the contract that we've had in place with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the business agreement that we have in terms of their paying for the fire-related costs.
Okay, very good. Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am curious about sort of the historic picture on this. We've had fires in that area, some very large fires in that area over the last few years. If there's a way for me, I'd like to see where those other fires were.
Sure.
I recall several, and I'd just be curious to see, you know, how they intersect with where things are.
Right. Chair, Representative Frederick, we could do that now just to kind of generally look at where the Biscuit Fire, that's maybe the one that you're hearing about from the past, basically being essentially to the west of the Big Windy Fire to the left in that green block of national forest land. Something that would be of interest, you know, we'd be glad to provide you with a map that looks at the fire history, and I think actually Mike Clausey may have some imagery as well coming up that looks at fire history in Western Oregon. If you were out on the land this summer working on the Big Windy Fire, you in some cases could look across the ridge and see the Biscuit Fire, and the footprints are still very visible. And that is the nature, you know, as Senator Birchiger said when he opened up here, the nature of this landscape is fire was here first, and it's, you know, it's going to be here, and those signs are definitely there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Doug, looking at the map, is it the luck of the draw? BLM lands get more lightning strikes than other landowners, or what are the reasons for the blow up in BLM lands?
Well, as we know, the fuel conditions were ripe. Okay, Travis has kind of illustrated that as well as Senator Birchiger. I think, you know, the random nature of lightning and the kind of the capricious, unpredictable nature of the way a weather pattern will move across the landscape determines where you're going to get the fires. What's the variable there has to do with how you're prepared for that, the level of access that you have to that kind of area, as well as the fuel conditions that are in place when those lightning strikes strike. So, I think the pattern that you see on the landscape here of fire really is just chance in terms of the way lightning will strike. Those other variables, you know, maybe there's a connection with other longer-term factors and trends.
And we've had a couple of people discuss forest health already today. Does forest health, what role does forest health play in terms of the fires that occurred on the BLM lands?
I think that probably the most significant forest health issues that we face in Oregon are over on the east side. Undoubtedly, there are pockets and pieces in this landscape where kind of mortality relative to forest health is an issue. I think that there are definitely indicators and elements associated with the overall vigor of those stands, particularly as it relates to the fuel buildups. You know, I think that is going to be the largest variable relative to the BLM stands.
Okay. Yep. Thank you very much. Any additional questions?
Question.
Yes, Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, I'm looking at your pictures here, and some of these we've thinned, and some of them we have not thinned. This one here is unbelievably close quarters for all the trees involved. Now, if we thin those, and this is something I have to grapple with, if we thinned them, how would you keep the brush out of them when they're small? When you reforest, how do you keep the brush down with competing with the new reforestation of the planting of the small tree?
Vice Chair Escanel, there's a variety of methods that are available. No doubt thinning makes a difference in terms of how a fire will move through and move into a stand. And there's, you know, that's documented, and, you know, we can show that. In terms of managing the herbaceous layer, the small brush and green stuff that comes up underneath there, there's a variety of ways that range from the use of chemicals to hand release and actually getting in and going in and removing the competing brush by hand. And really, that's a land landowner choice. The landowners have different options that are available to them that they'll exercise depending on what their land management objectives and what their budget is.
What's the federal government doing on their lands?
To my knowledge, the federal government does not allow the use of herbicides as a young stand management tool on their lands.
So are they going in and taking care of any of this brush or not, or just letting it go?
I think it really depends on the area. It depends on the level of capacity of the individual jurisdictional unit, the forest or the ranger district or the unit. Those are variables that are there.
And I also see a trend in Southern Oregon where maybe we had a fire 40, 50 years ago, and Manzanita and Madrone are taking over instead of our Douglas fir and our pines.
From our
common practice?
From our standpoint, having a greater degree of resiliency on the landscape is number one. We've been pushing very hard with our federal partners to invest in fuel management, to look at active management as a mechanism to try to, over time, change the fuel model that's there on the ground as a way of limiting costs and losses, as well as trying to generate the social, economic, and environmental benefits that we all need.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next, I'll call up Phil Adams, and I'm going to slay this, Javier. Trust me. I'm not going to try it.
And
who is it, Mike Wilson?
No, Heath. Heath Curtis.
Yep. Sorry.
We'll do those first. There you go.
All right. Chair Wood, Vice Chair Escobar, members of the committee. My name is Heath Curtis, and I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Thank you for holding this valuable hearing today. Sitting with me is Phil Adams, who's a timberland manager with Roseburg Forest Products. And I also have with me Javier Goyri-Goldari, who is with Communities for Healthy Forests. They're going to speak to you a little bit about private land management in the face of wildfire, in the face of wildfire risk from adjoining lands, and frankly some of the frustrations arising out of those mixed ownerships like you see in Southwest Oregon. I did want to take the opportunity before I handed it over to them to echo, frankly, the sentiment of Representative Unger. The Oregon Department of Forestry did a valiant job this summer from all counts that we've heard. And frankly, the additional resources brought to bear, including the $3 million by Oregon's landowning community, helped. That is to say, this was a bad summer, but it could have been a lot worse. A lot worse. And so with that, Phil's going to speak first. He's got some pretty shocking photos, I think, that you'll want to see, and then Javier.
Thank you, Chair Witt, not here, but committee members. Thanks for the opportunity. I submitted a map packet. There's four maps in that packet, and I'd like to, just through my presentation, be able to refer to those. So I have a presentation basically focusing in on the Douglas Complex fires and giving you a private landowner's perspective of the fire season of 2013. Just for context, and that's where map number one of the packet comes in, I wanted to show the ownership pattern that a private company like Roseburg Forest Property or Roseburg Forest Products operates in. We operate in what we call the ONC lands. You've seen multiple slides and maps of that today, but on my map you can see in red that is the Roseburg Forest Property or Roseburg Forest Products properties, and you can just see the juxtaposition of the lands that we own and where we own them. 85% of our land base is in the ONC lands, And we just don't have anywhere else to go to manage our business, which is growing trees on a sustainable yield basis and supplying those trees to our manufacturing facilities in Douglas County. We have four facilities. We're the largest employer in Douglas County at those facilities, as well as I run a staff of 45 professional foresters, engineers, and analysts that add to our economy in that area also. So my theme here is that the checkerboard is a very difficult place to manage timberland. These are mountainous terrain timberlands, and when we add the multiple layers of federal land allocations into that mix, it becomes even more challenging. It requires, in my perspective, and this is a piece that I've seen in my career of 30 years, a responsible neighbor policy to be able to, for both parties to operate here. From my perspective, this is the model that private landowners and the federal government, especially the BLM, have operated under in the ONC. And I'm referring this to kind of pre-Northwest Forest Plan. The first principle is legal access. You can't manage timberlands, especially in a checkerboard fashion, without legal access. And fortunately, the biggest piece of work that both the federal government and the private landowners cooperated on was the reciprocal right-of-way agreements of Western Oregon. Importantly, they're assignable, which means they run with the land, and they provide very prescriptive, non-discretionary requirements that both parties have to abide by. And so it's been tested through time, a very valuable tool that makes us responsible and accountable to each other. Typically, we've have the same common interest. Before the Northwest Forest Plan, both parties were in the timber production business, using sustained yield management concepts, science-based harvest and regeneration. Post-Northwest Forest Plan, those interests and practices have diverged, but remaining in the common interest piece is fire prevention and suppression. Neither landowner wants to see either small fires or large fires. We have too much value at risk, although we view our resources differently today than we might have 20 years ago. They're still valuable. Another principle is the idea of adjacency. When you have that checkerboard, whether directly or indirectly, the neighbors or the landowners affect each other. And so through notification and relationships, we've always had a good understanding that we're neighbors to each other. And then the other piece, and I think we sometimes forget about this, is that it's true. I mean, fire is part of the landscape. It's part of our environment in Western Oregon. It happens from time to time. But when it does happen, we've always recognized it as a catastrophic event. We've reacted cooperatively and proactively together. The piece, as an example that I throw out there, is the Oxbow Fire of 1996. And on that overview map, I just show you that it's personal to Roseburg because the Oxbow footprint is in the northern portion of our ownership now. It was previously, during the fire event, owned by IP, but through acquisition, we've inherited the benefits of that old model because it's a healthy young forest. In fact, we're placing our first harvest entries into those previous fire areas today. So you've seen Travis and the Senator Bershiger really set this up very well for me. It's interesting. You'll see common themes in my presentation as theirs. July 26th, 2013, at 13:30 hours is when this picture was taken. So basically 1:30. And this is the landscape, the working forest of our area down in the Cow Creek, Middle Creek drainage. If I can use my clicker correctly, this is Cow Creek drainage right here. This large ridge right here is Rabbit Mountain proper, and this significant drainage in the middle is Middle Creek. You can see at 1330, kind of incipient stage, fire starts. All of these had people working on them. I was working with a crew right here. We had a crew right here. This piece had spent the morning with a lot of heavy water because access was an issue. And you can just see it's kind of a faint wisp there. That'll change, as I'll show you. Looking over here in the distance, that's the Dad's Creek Fire. And right there is also brimstone. So quite a fire environment there. And I throw on this next overlay because it's the reality of our world. The ONC is a combination of private and mixed ownership. And I took the liberty to draw those ownership lines onto the oblique just to kind of demonstrate the environment we're working in there. And then also to just demonstrate also the trend that we're seeing is that fire starts on this dry lightning event were very much concentrated on the BLM ownership in that larger stand component. I counted 10 separate ignition points in that photo in the foreground. Typical of dry lightning, and I think it's important to keep reminding ourselves of that. They tend to be ridgetop ignition points. But in this event where it was concentrated and it just kind of sat over the landscape and threw down strike after strike, we saw significant mid-slope ignition points also. And it wasn't for lack of initial attack that these fires got going and did what they did. It was a valiant effort by the Douglas Fire Protective Association and the state with initial attack. Here's an example you've seen of just a bomber run on a ridgetop ignition point. But to earlier comment, some of it just got away. And the phenomena that we saw over and over on both day one, day two, and day three was really significant preheating. Here was that ignition point number three. Remember I was calling it a wisp earlier in that previous photo? Here at 1416, so literally 45 minutes later, that ignition point, because it was sitting on those steep slopes, it had aspect, and most importantly, fuel. That's the big common denominator to all of this is the fuel loads in these older timber types. It started preheating and progressing. So from preheating, the phenomena we saw during the burning period almost systematically at 3 o'clock, you heard that comment earlier, the 3 o'clock, we called it the witching hour. Basically, it was when preheating had progressed to a point that you could actually get crowning runs coming out of those areas. This is the same spot from a different vantage point, but I'm documenting the progression of that Rabbit Creek fire as it started. Interestingly, why I put this one in, and Travis did too, this is striking from a fire management perspective. A plume-dominated fire is bad, bad, bad. Bad things are happening underneath in that zone right there, where basically a crowning fire is dominating the landscape. The heat release is so extreme that all age classes of timber, whether it's a young 5-year-old plantation type on managed private land or an older timber type on federal land, it's all getting consumed. 100% mortality is occurring during that event. Again, similar to Travis, I put that in there because in my career, I mean, you just don't see this very often. This double plume of tilted column, what that thing is doing, it's building heat and releasing energy at such a rapid rate that it's all the fuel that it's consuming or is actually being lifted into the column. In later progression photos, I'm sure we would have seen that it was spotting at least a half to three-quarters of a mile in front of itself during that first day. Just tremendous a fire. Similar to day one, day two, if you were out on the fire lines and in the area, you saw as the burning period progressed, 1:30 it started getting hot. You could feel the wind starting to suck together. That column started to build. A crowning fire generally came out of the older timber types at the witching hour of 3 o'clock. Here's a picture of the day two firestorm during going at it. You can see they're not joined together, but Rabbit Mountain to the left and Dad's Creek to the right, both in plume-dominated fire. Just another striking picture. You can just see the extent of spread at this point in time. By day two, both fires were literally over 10,000 acres apiece. So 5,000 acre runs on average during the two burning periods is kind of what we saw. The aftermath is pretty striking. At the landscape level, I'm sitting in a helicopter and I'm looking up Cow Creek. Here's Cow Creek right down there with a BLM access road on the left and a very valuable short line railroad track on the right following the creek grade. But I'm at that interface, if you will, of where the firestorm occurred on day two. And then and to the right of that picture is other what we would call dirty burn areas in later portions of the fire. But certainly a striking and very devastating, catastrophic event. Just pictures of the firestorm areas, extreme damage in all age classes. I'm focusing on a piece of property that we were very proud of. Had accomplished all of the forestry and silviculture work to have a very thriving stand of managed trees that were part of our future, literally up in smoke in less than 3 hours. The burn had two components, and that's I would refer you to maps 3 and 4, where I'm showing the progression in map 3, and then in map 4, the an intensity or fire intensity map. But in both of those maps, I'm showing the kind of what I'm calling the core firestorm areas. To me, that's the story of the fire. But there's other areas associated with the fire that we call the dirty burn areas. They were just a function of day four through the end of the suppression effort of just trying to find a way to stop that animal. And it results in just kind of a spotty burn of consumption and non-consumption. So just quantifying and putting a picture of what that loss inside the fire area represents for Roseburg. We had a little bit north of 11,000 acres inside the fire perimeter. 70% of that, or 7,000 acres, is what we would call our pre-merchantable growing stock. Those were managed stands anywhere from 1 year old to less than 35 years old. The average age in our inventory system was 21 years old. So for us, that was that time cost of money piece that we're talking about. 20-year-old stands, to lose that is a significant loss for anybody. We also lost merchantable volume, about 4,100 acres, a little bit of around 45 million board feet. And so at least for Roseburg, in a very uncertain environment, we're going to pick up the pieces and reinvest. Contrary to Representative Krieger's remark about that it's statutorily required at this point in time, that's not true, or the fact. The Forest Practices Act requires reforestation as part of a harvest, but in terms of a catastrophic event, there's no statutory requirement for any landowner in Oregon to reforest. But we're going to, I mean, most prudent landowners and managers will. Our plan is to be very aggressive. In a three-year plan, we're going to get at least back to square one, which would be salvage of harvest salvage of our merchantable timber and reinvestment in reforestation. It's going to cost us, as we work through the numbers and think about what we're going to do, it's about a $6 million capital investment that we'll put in by the end of this. We'll focus first on roads and improvements, and then concurrently with that, we're developing our salvage program. In fact, we've got the first piece of our salvage program intact right now, and we're operating on that. We want to have all of our salvage program completed in 12 to 18 months, and then it's just because of logistics and the process of growing trees or seedlings and preparing the land, we're planning a three-year reforestation program on about 8,000 acres, planting about 3.2 million trees. Just pictures showing the challenge in front of us. From simple, from a forester's perspective, replanting a stand for a five-year-old type that was basically vaporized in the firestorm area is relatively simple. We'll directly plant into that to perform silvicultural treatments for the first 2 years to get our trees established and be back in business. But things start getting a little bit more complicated as we think about replacing our 15-year-old stands. These are really pre-merchantable. They're stands that when they were green and growing, they were adding increment and value every year, but they're too small to economically recover. Mm-hmm. And we're scratching our heads, quite frankly, what to do with those stands when they're on steep cable ground. We'll probably just plant through them and let that smaller diameter stand disintegrate over time. It gets more challenging when you look at our 25-year-old pole stands, thrifty, dense stands. Contrary to misconception, this is the desired condition of our stands on a managed landscape. We want a dense stand. There's about 300 trees per acre here. That stand was pre-commercially thinned at one point in time. But at this point, we're going to have to do something to take that overstory of dead skeletonized trees off the land, and it'll be a logging prescription that won't generate income, but it has to happen to reduce the fuel loading, the reburn potential, and just basically open up the site again so that we can reforest.
Phil, I get a bit of a problem here. Your presentation is excellent.
That's too long.
But I've got a number of people I have to accommodate after you. Is it possible to kind of summarize at this point?
I apologize.
No, we very much appreciate you put a lot of effort into this, and it's an incredible presentation. But I'm sorry.
No, it's not a problem. There's a lot to say, and maybe I'm saying too much. The issue here that we're having is we're going to do our thing in the ONC. We're going to reinvest. We're going to get back to square one. We're going to move on. I'm really concerned, though, that my neighbor has kind of changed his game plan a little bit, and I think from where we were in 1966, when the two landowners worked together, we're really concerned that we don't see that same shared vision today. Given what we understand today, we can expect the federal partner to at least ensure safety and road access into those fire areas. But from there, it's really all bets are up. There may be limited salvage on the federal lands. There may be even more limited reforestation. And that's an issue because snag patches and brush fields are not the way to manage this landscape going forward. And so really, I mean, finally for me, it's just recognition, and there's no serious ask here of you other than we're going to do our step. I intend to work with the local federal managers to ensure that we can develop a shared vision. But if we can't, we're looking for help from the community and at higher levels to insist on some sort of action that's proactive and expedient that we can count on to reforest these catastrophic event areas. So with that, thank you for the
thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. Javier.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being here. And if I can, and I'm going to express my apologies in advance, but I'm going to have to move this agenda. So if you could hit the high points, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay. I'll try to keep this moving along. And I believe you have before you my written comments that I'll be going through. But briefly, thank you very much, Chairman Witt, members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to be here to discuss the issue of our these burning forests. And in particular, I'm going to talk about the federal forest lands, which the impacts that they're having across the state. I'm Javier Guerra-Gothari. I'm a certified professional forester, and I'm here to speak today on behalf of Communities for Healthy Forests that came to life after the drastic fires of 2002 in southwest Oregon, where we saw nearly 750,000 acres of forest land burned in one summer. And the ensuing disappointment in the community when over 1 year later there were still no definitive action plans to recover the losses and to replant the future forest. So those blackened landscapes provided the backdrop for the sadness at the loss and the steely resolve of our group to act to end these catastrophes. We were dismayed that as soon as the smoke cleared, the media moved on to another story, and so did the public's alarm. Surely we thought if we could put the blackened forests in and the developing brush fields in front of the public and the decision makers, they would soon understand. That was 10 years ago, and the problem remains now, and perhaps even worse. It's no secret that throughout the West we are experiencing hotter, far more devastating fires. We know that our fire season in Oregon is weeks longer than it was a few decades ago. The snowpack is lighter, the snowmelt is earlier, spring rains end sooner, and fall rains come later. But the finger-pointing is rampant as to the blame. Too many carbon emissions, it's global warming, it's climate change, etc. It's also no secret that we're spending far more to put these fires out as well. The blame is cast towards too many new homes in the secluded forests. However, if you look at the numbers, they disagree. While admittedly people have moved away from urbanized settings, at what rate have they done so? It was just 15 years, we've seen the cost of fighting fires go up 3 to 4 times. In 2012, nearly $2 billion was spent on fire suppression. In contrast to that, only 25% of that amount was spent on fuels reduction efforts, and perhaps as little as $250 million went to actual work on the ground. While the suppression costs were high, it is only a fraction of the total cost of the fires, when, as we have heard earlier today, when all of the costs of repairs, the degradation of air and water quality, the loss to the habitat, the loss of revenues, the loss of lives are considered. And the residents of Colorado certainly continue to struggle with their flash floods coming off the burn scars. The actual reason we're having these fires is largely due to the buildup of so much fuel across the vast landscapes. After the millennia of Indian burning and lightning fires, we have effectively suppressed every fire for the last 75 years. And in the meantime, these forests, the greatest solar panel never invented by man, have grown more dense. By some estimates, each acre accumulates the equivalent energy of 300 gallons of gasoline each and every year. While the private land's growth is fairly balanced by harvest and mortality, for 20 years now, the federal lands in western Oregon have been growing six times more than what the harvest and mortality combined. And most of the mortality, the deadwood, is left in place. These federal lands grow in excess of 5 billion board feet of timber each year. As forest health conditions have deteriorated in the past 20 years, so has the health of our rural communities. We've seen a 90% drop of federal timber harvest cause a serious dislocation around the state in just a few short years. When you consider that each 10 million board feet of timber sustains 11 jobs, the withdrawal of 2 billion board feet is cataclysmic. Mills with long-term supplies of raw material employed many in the industry as well as related sectors, provided stability to the families. The revenue sharing from the timber receipts and the tax bases funded the operations of schools and counties. And the result was a domino effect in the forest-dependent communities. School enrollments have declined. Roseburg School District lost 12% of the student population in 15 years alone, nearly 700 students. That's a $4 million hit to their annual budget. This is 50 fewer jobs for teachers in Roseburg alone. And more rural schools in Douglas County have lost 30 to 40% of their enrollment. A lot of those kids moved into Roseburg. In Grant County, Representative Benz's district, Superintendent Mark Witte estimates that a decline of 60% of student enrollment in 10 years. Burns High School in neighboring Harney County was a blue ribbon school in the 1980s. Today, the enrollment is down 40%, and the school is only in session for 4 days. So these are some photos of an aftermath of a fire. This is taken in 2007, 11 years after a 16,000-acre fire that burned out of the heart of the Boulder Creek Wilderness Area in the Umpqua National Forest. Notice the arrow in the photo point there.
Javier, with us running out of time, can you hit the high points and summarize?
I'll do that.
Appreciate
so,
that. Thank you.
So, the year following, it caught fire. You see the snags. They could not put any firefighters on the ground because of the severe hazard. The only way they could attempt to stop that fire was through aerial attack, and it failed. That's what it looked like after the fire. 2 years later, the brush is back. There's still 200 to 300 tons per acre of fuel on that ground. And today, I've got students that are helping me monitor plots there. The brush is over our heads and getting thicker. This was roadside timber that was burned. Perfectly viable, salvageable, valuable, and fuel for the future. We were told we could not remove it because it would have to require an environmental impact statement. 2 weeks later, I came back, and they had started cutting all those trees down and hauling them off with the signature of a pen. This is National Forest land. They could not sell it to a mill. They could not generate revenue, but they could hire people to go in and remove those hazard trees and that hazardous fuel, along the roadside. The rest of the 20,000 acres is still there, rotting away, fuel for the next fire. This is the Timbered Rock Fire. This burned in 2002. 27,000 acres. It started up on the south end of the Umpqua National Forest. As Phil described in the Douglas Complex and these fires, it's the BLM private interface. The darker areas are where the BLM had planned on doing some salvage, fuel treatment, reforestation, some research. 2 years after the fire, a judge enjoined the entire project. Nothing was done on the BLM lands. In contrast, the private landowner was Boise Cascade at the time, went in and aggressively treated their lands. They reinvested. They salvaged what they could. They replanted it all. And today, these trees, now 10 years old, are 20 feet tall and growing. That's responsible management. This is what the BLM ground looks like. Just snags. They did plant some trees in there. You can here and there you can find a tree that is scattered out, but it's all covered with brush, dominated by brush and snags across the entire landscape. So we have a problem. We need to address it, and Communities for Healthy Forests is actively engaged with the Forest Service and the BLM to try to get some work done on these landscapes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much. That was an exceedingly well put presentation. I want to thank all three of you for the effort that you've put into this. It is very significant, and I think what you've tried to portray here is very dramatic. So I thank you. With that, Vice Chair Esquivel.
One quick question. Does anyone have any monetary cost between the two scenarios you just showed us, Boise Cascade and BLM? Because I think I'd heard something on that line quite some time ago about those two units. That one unit costs $1,500, another unit costs $400 an acre. Is there any validity to that? Because I was told that the BLM's was $1,500 and the Boise Cascade was $400 an acre.
Comparing what I have seen there done on that BLM ground with other BLM work that was done in Douglas County. In Douglas County, they were spending on the order of $1,000 to $1,500 an acre, but they were going in repeatedly with chainsaws and cutting down the brush after they had planted the trees. I've not seen any brush cut there. They stuck the trees in the ground, and if they survive, they survive. They don't. So I can't speak to that. Private line.
I might just comment, Representative Esquivel. On a comparative acre, if I had an acre of private land that I would reforest using our techniques, planting large seedlings, giving it herbaceous weed control, and thorough site preparation for the first 2 years to get it established, generally that cost is, for the way we do it, anywhere between $500 and $600 an acre. To do that equivalent acre, using tools other than herbicides, which the federal government is banned from doing. They have no forestry-labeled herbicides available for their use. That $1,000 to $1,500 price tag is a fair estimate to get the kind of manual weeding. Instead of using herbicides, they'd place mulch. You've seen those mulch squares. To put one of those down on an acre is about $600 a shot. I mean, it's very expensive to do manual reforestation, especially on tougher sites like we see down in southwestern Oregon. So those numbers are fair. We've penciled those through in our own thinking.
Additional questions or comments? Representative Krieger. Nothing. Javier, I think you were trying to make the point, and I want to be very clear that I didn't misunderstand what you were saying. You were showing the rather large saw log, and I think what you stated was that with that fire that occurred on federal land, there was a prohibition against the sale of that timber as a commodity product, but that we could, in fact, pay money to have that those fallen trees removed. Was that accurate?
Prohibition would not be the right word.
Okay.
But in order to conduct an activity removing dead trees, if there is no opposition, there's a fairly short process. They can do that to some extent. But if one person says, I have a problem with you doing that, you're going to need to do a full-blown EIS in order to validate that you're not causing any harm, then that throws it completely into another realm. And EISs on that kind of ground take 1 to 2 years. And by that time, the opportunity, the value of the wood has declined, particularly the small wood, because that's the big wood is valuable for snags, down habitat. You know, I get that. It's really valuable for a lot of things, but there's an ecological need for that kind of wood on the ground. That's okay. But if you want to remove the fuel, you want to remove the smaller materials that are perfectly good material to go into a sawmill or plywood mill or whatnot, like what Phil's talking about there, you need to get in there quickly, and you need to get it, remove it, because the deterioration happens at about 20 to 22% each and every year of delay. And if you lose 3 seasons, you've lost it. And that's what happened there.
Oh, what a shame. Yeah. Any additional questions? Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for an absolutely outstanding presentation. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you for your time and attention.
Absolutely. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Mike McClatsy.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Representative Witt, Co-Chair Escoval, and Frederick, and members of the committee, I'm Michael Clossy. I'm Director of Forestry with the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, and you have from me a copy of the PowerPoint, also a copy of a book called Fire in Oregon's Forests, and the final is an invitation to our board tour on October 3rd, in which we're going to be visiting the Berry Point Fire. When we started working with our board to put together the tour for this year back in April, that was the hottest fire going. If we were doing this starting from scratch, we'd probably be visiting the Douglas Complex. So anyway, I'll go very quickly.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that.
So basically, my report is very different from all the others because what I'm trying to do is give you a context and a perspective of fire in Oregon's forests. Fire is a big part of Oregon's forests, and this was unusual in forestry. Forestry was developed in Europe where forest fires never happened. It came to fruition in America on the East Coast, where fire is not a big part of the ecosystem. But once you get west of the 100th meridian, fire is the driver in our ecosystem. But it's different. So in this table, we show 7 or 8 main forest types in Oregon, and then there's a juxtaposition of the fire return interval and the fire severity. So forests like Willamette Valley Oak have fires very frequently, traditionally, every 2 to 20 years, but it was low severity, similar to ponderosa pine and dry mixed conifers. Fires are pretty frequent, but low severity. When you get to the coastal forests, the spruce and hemlock, forest fire natural cycle would be every 2 to 400 years, but when it fired, it would be a doozy. Think of the Tillamook burn. Douglas fir is kind of in the middle, 100 to 300 years, but it's a high fire. Down in the southwest Oregon fires this year, it was mostly in what we call the mixed conifer forest, the wet mixed conifer, natural fire cycle anywhere from 40 to 80 years, and you get mixed or moderate. So it's very different. So to look at these quickly, low-intensity ponderosa pine, frequent fires, give open park-like stands, you maintain the large fire-resistant trees. Like picture going by Sisters or Camp Sherman. I mean, that's what the low intensity is. As we've kept fire out of the ecosystem for 100 years, we've had tremendous fuel buildup, and instead of getting those low-intensity ground fires, we get high-intensity crown fires. Think of the B&B fire. Everything burnt very, very hot, had a stand replacement. The Douglas fir, which is our most common in the west side, has a long fire cycle of 100 to 300 years, and they're in big patches. So this was based on data collected by surveyors in 1850 when they did the original land survey. This dark green is all stuff over 200 years. If you looked at that today, it's way less than that. This was the Tillamook burn. Doug fir tend to, when you have a fire, it's not very often, but when you have one, it's a doozy. Wet mixed conifer is somewhere in between. You get mixed intensity, lethal and non-lethal. They're patchy fires. They're aspect dependent. So on the south slopes, they burn very hot, stand replacement fires. On the north slopes, it's a creeping around, other way around. South slopes, creeping around fire would be the natural. The north slopes would be a stand replacement fire. So what we need to do is to manage the fuels, as mentioned. This is a fire history of Oregon going back to 1960. We were really good at suppressing fires until the fuels got away from us, and then we got really, really bad. And I apologize, this stopped in 2010 when I looked at updating it. 2011 and 2012 were pretty low, but we'll update it in 2013. We'll be off the scale. So it's definitely in the past 20 years we've had a tremendous amount of fires. And the reason is because we've had really good fire suppression that allowed the fuel to build up. We've also had a steep reduction in federal timber harvest. Active management is one of the keys to keeping fuels reduced. We've also at the same time had urbanization, a lot more rural living in places like Jackson and Deschutes County. The words of the Nature Conservancy, they say our forests are out of whack. Their measure shows that about 9.5 million acres of our east side forests are not healthy, mostly because of too many trees. The answer is active management. Fuel needs to be produced. If you're thinking, you know, when the fire department came to your grade school, they talked about heat, oxygen, and fuel. To stop the fire, you got to put out one of those. On the landscape, it's weather, topography, and fuel. We can't do anything about the weather but complain. We can't change the topography, but the fuel is what we can do something about. So if you would have a surface fire that would burn into, this is a wet mix conifer stand that hasn't had fire for 80 years. The surface fire, if there wasn't a lot of ladder fuels and mid-crown trees, would be stay a surface fire. Instead, because we have mid-crown trees and ladder fuels, it becomes a crown fire. And it's really just a matter of fuel. The more fuel you have, the worse the fire is. To wit, the BLM fires in southwest Oregon this year. I mean, on the private lands, it was a different fuel model than on the public lands, on the federal lands versus private. So we're trying new ways. We deal with by thinning, pruning, mowing, and prescribed fire. All have been used. Most of the effort has been on the east side. This is an example on the Deschutes National Forest. This was before the thinning to remove the dead and reduce the number of trees, and this was after thinning and prescribed burning. So it's pretty common to have a situation where this is your fire. This is near Subtle Lake. This is the road into the campground. After the spruce budworm and other disease problems, they had way overstocked stands with a lot of dead trees. They did a thinning to remove them. They did a prescribed burning. This picture on the bottom is before the B&B fire. This picture is after the B&B fire. You can't tell the difference. If you flew over Subtle Lake and saw the area around the lake where they had done the thinning and done the scribe burning and then saw the B&B fire, it's like flying over a green donut. The donut hole is the lake. The green part is all the part where they did the treatments. The dead part was where they didn't get the treatment. So it really is the key to active management. And I know you all have made a lot of efforts. The governor's budget, Department of Forestry, the Forest Service are really moving towards active management. But the message I would have for you is that Oregon's forests are at risk of uncharacteristically intense fires, mostly because of too much fuel. We can't eliminate fire from the ecosystem, but we can reduce the fire intensity to historic norms, and the key is active management. So that's the five-minute version. Questions?
Great job. Thank you very much. Who has a question or a comment? I think you got it all nailed down, Mike.
All right.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. And with that, we're going to switch gears now. We're going to talk about the proposed Grassy Mountain gold mine in Malheur County. And okay. And I want to thank everyone who turned out for our forest fire presentations. Greatly appreciated. And great work, Oregon Department of Forestry. Thank you. Okay. I'd like to call up, please, next, Vicki McConnell, Randy Jones, and Vance Thornsberry, please. Okay. Thank you. I don't think he'll mind if these welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. Please determine among yourselves the order of your presentation.
Chair Witt and Vice Chair Escobar and Frederick and committee members, Vicki McConnell, the Oregon State Geologist, I would respectfully suggest that we start with Mr. Thornsberry to give an overview of this particular proposed area, and you have a better understanding of when we talk about the boring regulatory part of it, if you understand what we're talking about.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairs, distinguished members of the committee. My name is Vance Thornsberry. I'm the Vice President of Exploration for Calico Resources Corporation, and I'm from Spokane, Washington. On behalf of Calico, I'd like to, we really appreciate the opportunity to present to you today. This isn't the Grassy Mountain Project, by the way. This is the range of hills down on the California-Nevada border that we named the company after. It's called the Calico Hills. This slide is a bit immaterial. It's a necessity for public companies. I think it says something to the effect of believe everything you do, half of what you see, and none of what you hear. A bit about Calico's background is about 3 years ago, the chairman of the corporation, Buck Morrow, and myself decided we were going to form a new exploration and mining company in the western U.S. We'd both come off of a fairly lengthy and good jobs over in Scandinavia, and we were ready to come home. We operate in Oregon. As Calico Resources USA Corp, primary corp was is a BC founded company, and we just use that as a vehicle for moving forward. We kicked a lot of tires from 2010 until early 2011, looking for the right project, and that ended up being Grassy Mountain. Our focus now is solely on Grassy Mountain for high-grade underground mine and mill facilities we hope to build there. Grassy Mountain is located in eastern Malheur County. It's about 60 miles west of Boise and about 23 miles from Vail. As you can see on this side, this would be the agricultural lands along Nyssa, Ontario, Vail, and the towns themselves. The ground in through here is administered by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. It is predominantly semi-arid, high desert land that's managed for grazing. These are two views of Grassy Mountain. The one on the right is the Grassy Mountain deposit itself on this ridgeline. It really should be called the Grassy Knoll because it's located north of and quite a few hundred feet lower in elevation than the actual Grassy Mountain. Grassy Mountain project itself is north of the watershed that drains the Owyhee River. Grassy Mountain drains north towards Cheville and not into the Owyhee watershed. The lower photo is a picture of looking from the top of Grassy Mountain to the north to give you an idea of what the landscape is like there. The takeaway on this slide is the project was the property was developed. It was found by two geologists, a couple of peers of mine, back in 1984. There's been approximately $30 million spent on this project in the past by a number of companies, notably Noranda and Atlas. We acquired the property in 2011, verified the resource, and we did quite a bit of work on our economic models. The first thing we did actually on this property is we did a due diligence, an environmental due diligence. We hired an environmental consulting firm out of Reno to say, okay, what's it going to be like to permit this? And they came back and said, they didn't appear that there was any major obstacles in the permitting. There was no threatened endangered species. There was no surface water to be too concerned about. We said, well, how about permitting in Oregon? And they said, well, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, we would have advised against it. But in the current climate, he said, in reality, there's very little difference in permitting in Oregon than there is the rest of the surrounding western states. The reason they would have been hesitant to do that 20 years ago was because of Division 37 chemical mining law. Since that time, the other states have imposed more stronger restrictions on permitting, and so Oregon is about par for power, par with the course. It's a different procedural situation, but similar to the other states. This is a discovery outcrop at Grassy Mountain. It's kind of like what this would be, the closest thing you would see on the property that might be close to mineralized material. Skip Yates, still alive, he took us out there last year and showed us this. The TRT, full TRT committee, or those who could attend were there. Discovery drill hole was about a quarter of a mile away up on top of Grassy Mountain here, Grassy Mountain, the deposit. The project area that that we refer to, three things on here. The red is the patented claims. There's 62 acres there that are that will involve the mining site. There is the haul and or call it an access road. It's a 3-mile road. It's across BLM land. It goes over to this yellowish ground here, and this is the Bishop Branch, which we have under lease. The area here on the north northeast corner of the private land is the area that we're looking at for a proposed plant site. Quickly on the land position, the proposed mine and mill facilities are going to both be on patented ground. A patented load mining claim means you own the surface, you own the minerals below you, you own the airspace above it. That's where the mining is going to take place. We're going to truck it 3 miles over to fee simple ranch land. The permit that we have applied for is 270 acres. We expect to use about 175 of those acres for mining and milling. That compares with Malheur County, which contains approximately 6 million acres. Total land position, you guys can read that. As a geologist, I have to talk a little bit about the geology. This is a hot springs-type deposit. The closest analog to that would have been the Cannon Mine in Wenatchee, Washington. Cannon Mine had actually two mines there, one of which was inside the city limits of Wenatchee. The other one was just outside of it. They both produced about 500,000 ounces. There's one more project up there that still has about 500,000 ounces, but it's under buildings and houses and everything else. Other mines similar to that would be McLaughlin in California, and you've probably heard of Sleeper in Nevada. It's probably the largest of the ones, very high grade. We're looking at mining only the high-grade portion of the deposit. That high-grade portion is about 2.4 million tons. It's contained in a very small area. It's about 1,000 feet long by 600 feet wide by about 200 feet high, shaped kind of like a potato. It contains nearly 750,000 ounces and about 1 million ounces of silver. This is what the rock would look like. This is from drill core that's been split or sawn, actually. What you see here, this is a jarosite mineral. This is like a vein or veinlets. This is commonly associated with the gold. These are quartz edullary veinlets, and right here, if I had my glasses on, is a little bit of free gold. In case you think this is the only one out there, when Atlas announced their nearly 1 million ounce deposit, it caused a kind of a mini rush to the state of Oregon back in the late 80s, early 90s. The ground from Nevada, Nevada border on both sides of the river, on both Oregon and in Idaho, all the way up to Farewell Bend, was pretty well stake solid. Every one of the yellow dots on here represents a gold prospect, whether it is gold mineralization, whether it's economic or not. Each one of those stars represents gold mineralization where there is a resource. There is enough drilling and enough information to put together a resource. Grassy Mountain, of course, is located here. It's at the intersection of two well-mineralized trends. Calico hopes to someday be coming along and saying, hey, we'd like to start permitting number two, because I think number two is going to be a lot faster than number one. This is our announced resources. And when you look at these numbers, resources are called and measured, indicated, and inferred. Measured is your highest category. That means you have a lot of confidence in the amount of material that's there and the value of that material. By law, I can add measured and indicated. I cannot include inferred. Inferred is a little lower category. So this is where we come up with the values we're talking about here. 9.45 grams, it's a little less than 0.3, 0.275, 0.28. We intend to mine this as an underground operation where we've looked at a number of mining rates and ways to mine it, and it looks like 1,000, 1,200 ton a day mining. We'd probably mine 5 days a week, three shifts a day. The milling portion would be 7 days a week, 24/7. The underground mining method is going to be called cut and fill. We'll do that through a decline where it's about a decline about 12% that will go down into the end of the ore body. It'll probably ramp around it, and then we'll cross cut over to the ore body, and then we'll mine out from top down. And I'll have a slide here that shows a little bit more how we do that. We're looking at a closed circuit milling operation. It is zero discharge. And it's pretty simple. It's gravity, and then it's followed by cyanide vat leaching. If Division 35 would have been what it is from what the regulations that you guys have gone through and passed last year had been in place, we could equally as well have permitted this under Division 35. That we could have floated the material rather than dissolve it with cyanide. We're kind of down the track on 37, so we're gonna finish what we're doing. The way we'll handle the tailings will be with a tailings management system, but they'll either be paste or they'll be dry. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, we want to be able to landform the tailings, the waste material left over after you process it. We want to be able to reclaim these as we go, and of course, completely reclaim it when we're through. There is a potential to return a significant portion of the tailings underground, because what we'll do underground is we'll come in there with a cemented backfill that will consist of sand component, cement, and aggregate and or waste rock. The underground mining scheme here, actually you can see it better on this one. This would be the decline where we have the decline coming down into, and you're going to cross cut over to the ore body. You're going to cut. You'll come in here and you'll mine that one. You'll fill it. You'll leave yourself a pillar or a 10-foot section. Come over here and mine the next one. Fill it. Come in here and mine this one. And then go on from there. This would be in cross-section while we mine it down from the top down. Our milling procedure, this would be a process flow sheet. The ore will be trucked over to the mill with highway trucks, 3-mile trucking, downhill. It's a pretty easy haul. It follows an existing BLM secondary road that we'll have to upgrade. The ore will be crushed, it'll be ground. And then at that point, it's going to go to a classifier, and it'll go over here to what's called a rougher gravity concentrator. And everything on this side of the flow sheet, the only thing we use here is gravity and water. On this side, and this will come back after it's went through the gravity system, back into the crushing grinding system classification. It goes into cyanide leach tanks, and this is a closed circuit situation here. It goes here to a liquid-solid separation, and the liquid, the gold-rich solutions, the silver solutions, they will go through what's called a Merrill-Crowe unit,
and we will produce a gold concentrate. At this point right here, what's very critical, what we do is we separate the solids. We'll rinse those solids one, maybe up to three times. You'll be continually taking analysis that you will analyze on site to see if there's one, is there any cyanide left? One, is there two? Are there any minerals left that are valuable minerals? Then we will put it through a cyanide destruction circuit, and you do that typically by using chlorine. From here, it goes out to the tailings. Typically, you'd run these in two or more cells. You'd strip the overburden off of this cell, put it over onto this one. We'd fill the first cell, and you keep putting lifts up as you go. When you get this up to a cell, the first cell is filled. You come over here, bring your overburden back, start reclaiming this. You're reclaiming as you go. Then we'll start using this cell, and this would be the portion that we would not put back underground. I'm going to go back on that if I can. It is zero discharge. This would be stormwater drainage system, so that you don't get any stormwater onto your cells. The water would go into a makeup water. We will reuse that water, and it goes back through the plant. This would just be like a BMP's it's the sediment control if there's anything that comes off of it. This is a cross section of what a typical tailings impoundment would look like. This will be a solid berm. You're going to build up your tailings through the various years here. This is kind of a cutout of that. Since this is just a schematic, it doesn't correspond to the DEQ lining regs, but what you have a filter cloth, you have a drainage system, you have compacted fill clay material. You'll probably have two liners in this, so that if there was anything in there, it's not going into the environment. These people beside me here are going to go into more detail than I will here on Division 37. So for a matter of time's sake, I'm going to kind of skip through Division 37. We're in this stage right here. We're collecting our baseline data, and we're also writing some portions of the operating plan and other portions of it. These are some of the other permits that are going to be required. How we'll go through it, reclamation closure, alternative analysis. I guess in addition to the, since Division 37 is a consolidated application permit, there are other situations or other things that we will have to do. We have to effectively interface with the BLM. Now, we may or may not get an MOU with the BLM, but the BLM is the BLM. I mean, that's their land. We also have to deal effectively with the county. We are enjoying a lot of really strong county and state support.
And with that, Vance, if I could interrupt you and get Representative Benson. He's in another committee, and I'd like to get him up and get his testimony, and so that we can get him back to his task at hand. So please excuse the interruption.
Thank you.
We were just talking about state support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cliff Benz, District 60. I'm handing out a couple of handouts that many of you have seen both, but one is what I've been calling the poverty card, but it's a reflection of my five counties' poverty rankings in the state of Oregon. And you'll see that, sadly, I have the most poverty-stricken county in Oregon, which is Malheur County, and that happens to be where Calico very happily is trying to place this on. The other document is a kind of an outline of what a local community groups have formed up and are attempting to coordinate activities such as Calico is engaging in with attempts to raise up our community from some of the more difficult challenges that poverty presents. And what we're doing is we're working with companies such as Calico to try to assure that we can offer employment to kids in our high schools not our colleges, because many of our kids don't go to college and have no chance of going to college. They're immigrants. Many have no money, and the most they can hope for is a good job upon graduation from high school. So recognizing this, we've been working with Calico and with other companies in the county to put together arrangements so that if Calico is successful in opening this mine, we would have good, high-paying jobs that we could offer to high school kids that would be trained up in coordination with our local community college. And so I've just given you those two sheets of paper to show first the dire straits we find ourselves in Malheur County, and in fact my other four counties, and to say if ever there was an opportunity to try to help, this mine is it. I also want to mention that one of the slides you just saw shows literally dozens of opportunities such as the one that Calico has spent so much money on and so much time that we could be using to help our rural areas. I want to say I had a most interesting conversation with another mining company that's interested in putting a mine down near McDermott. And the gentleman there pointed out that, as we heard a few minutes ago, Oregon has been more or less in a mining moratorium of sorts for about 40 years. And that's been good in some senses. It's been like a gigantic savings account that we have never really used. And also, during that time, the quality of mining has dramatically improved from an environmental standpoint. So, A, we've saved all of those great resources for these 40 years, and B, now we can extract them in a much more environmentally friendly way. That's all great, but how can we make sure that our local communities enjoy the benefits of these minerals that have been there for all these years? Because once they're gone, they're gone. And it may take 10, 15, 20 years for them to be mined, but what can we do to accrue to the community some of its benefit? And the answer would be train the kids. Give them jobs. And that means we'll take one natural resource, gold, uranium, silver, diamondaceous earth, which is already being mined, and use it as the foundation for helping people, our youth, into the future. So I can't compliment Calico enough for its efforts and the money it's spent and the investment and the risk it's taken. I really can't compliment Director McConnell enough for the efforts she's made to try to, for the first time, make our Division 37 rules work. It looks like they might, and this is hope for the community in my county. So I'm very happy, Mr. Chair, you asked for this hearing and gave us this opportunity.
Well, Representative Bentz, thank you, and we are so pleased that that you have this opportunity. And I would hope that we are able to facilitate it becoming a reality. So,
thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for
testimony so I can go back to my committee.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you again. With that?
Well, that was certainly high words of praise, and I thank the representative.
Absolutely.
After we get past or through the permitting hurdles and so forth that we're talking about here, it really only boils down to one thing. It's our duty to leave this thing as good or better than we found it and do the right thing. I mean, we can put all kinds of words out there. We can call them milestones. We can flower it up. But in the end, you have to do it right, because you won't get a second chance if you don't. And that can be in any industry. It's not just mining. Follow up on Representative Bentz's talk about some economic profile here, and I sure hope my numbers are somewhere close to his, because if they're not, please take his numbers. I won't dwell on this very much, other than to say that when you look at the per capita income here at Malheur County and the household incomes and down there, those are pretty low numbers.
Sure.
High unemployment, big county. low population base. So using that as a bit of a backdrop, you know, what can we do? What can we do to help that out? Well, a similar size project, I won't say how much ours is going to cost because I don't know yet, but it's going to cost between $90 and $120 million to build this. During construction, you're going to have 150 to 200 jobs. Construction will last about a couple of years. During operations, you'll have full-time 120 to 150 jobs, and that's 10 years as we know the resource right now, and we intend to grow it. And then you're going to have about 3 years of closure, and that looks at your life of mine at 15 years. The average employee cost that the company will incur is about $100,000 a year, and that breaks down to about $70,000 in salary and about $30,000 in benefits. Operating costs are going to be about $50 million a year. Those labor dollars are going to turn 5 to 8 times in the community. And a lot of the numbers that I'm coming here from are numbers that have recently been generated from the Oregon, or not Oregon, but the Idaho Business College. And they were developed for a property that's being permitted right now that Rick Richens, the other guy that was to be here with me today, Rick has some family medical problems. He just couldn't make it. But anyway, these are pretty new numbers. So those dollars are going to turn 5 to 8% in the community. We're looking at impacting about 175-200 acres here, but that 175-200 acres could have a 5% impact on the value of revenue into the county, and that's a big number. Again, from this study, state of Idaho, $1,400 a week plus benefits is about the average mining wages. So on our social license here, when we look at the PCC membership, it represents the various cities in Malheur County, the county government, state government, federal government. And going along with what Representative Bentz says, we have looked at partnering with Treasure Valley Community College. We've looked at the other hat that Mr. Jones wears in La Grande on some of the opportunities that might be there, and I'm very much in favor of getting some type of a situation in here where we can start pre-training this younger generation as our future employees. The other things that we do, we have had some consultation with the tribes. We have had some consultation with the NGOs. We have invited them to the table. Finally, in the permitting process, we go through what's called an environmental justice, and that will be essentially explaining to people exactly what we're doing and what the socioeconomic benefits are, and also what the problems might be. And I won't go any further than that. So anyway, sum this up on the socioeconomic effects: 120 to 150 full-time jobs. These are good family jobs. Annual payroll. These wages are higher when you compare them with any of the other major categories in the county, with the exception of federal. They're higher than agriculture. They're higher than construction. They're higher than light manufacturing. It's also going to create community jobs. We estimate that at 3 to 1 for every new job that comes in. We'll create another 3 jobs in the local community. This could be more depending upon the goods and services that are available in Malheur County and what, you know, from Nyssa, Vale, Ontario, and what will have to be brought in, because there will be new businesses that will have to be brought in specific for some of the mining goods and services.
Vance, can I get you to wrap up? And I apologize, but I've got a number of people behind you that I've got to get to. Thank you, sir.
This is what we hope it to look like whenever we're mining. This is what it's going to look like when we're done. This is the plant. This is what it's going to look like if it's done. These last 2 slides are just for your own information in case you need to contact us. And again, thank you very much for allowing us to give this presentation.
Well, thank you very much for that. It was very comprehensive. Good afternoon.
Good Good afternoon, Chair Witt and Vice Chairs and committee members. Again, my name is Vicki McConnell. I'm the Oregon State Geologist and the Director of the Ogami Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I know that we're running a little short on time, and so what I would suggest is I'm going to give you the very high-level, five-minute overview of the chemical process mining and turn it over to Mr. Jones from the EQ to talk a little bit in detail about the technical review team and some of the background work that's been done so far. Would that be sufficient, or is that still too, you want us to make it faster than that?
If you could do the 5 minutes in two or three,
yep,
it would be even
better. Yep, what I'll do is, and you've got a lot, we left some material with you, please, don't hesitate to come and talk with us if you have more, you know, more detailed questions or anything. But as has been mentioned, and you've heard Division 35 and Division 37, and just to clarify, what that is presently Oregon has the Oregon Chemical Process Mining Act, which is the legislation, and within that legislation, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries is the designated facilitating agency for a consolidated state permitting process for mines, hard rock chemical mines that would use a chemical processing. And the divisions that you're hearing, the Division 35 and Division 37 in particular, are our rules that implement that particular legislation. So you'll hear us saying, oh, it's under Division 37. Well, that's the chemical process mining rules to implement the act. So if you look at your little cheat sheet that I handed you there, I'm not going to go through all the charts. I'll go through a couple and then Randy can talk a little bit. The first blue chart you have here is the big overview of what the chemical process mining is. It's, as we said, it's a consolidated permitting process. Dogami facilitates. It gets all the state agencies together that has permitting responsibilities. We sit down. The PCC that Vance talked about is the project coordinating committee. That is a public meeting body that oversees the permitting, and the TRT is the technical review team that has representatives from all state permitting and advisory agencies that sit down and look over all of this information that the company has to get together for the permits, whether it's the background data that they have to collect for their state environmental impact, their socioeconomic survey, their operation plan, etc. So that's the technical group that oversees reviewing and giving permission to move on. Right now, in this little process, the companies come in with their notice of intent. They've gone through developing their background methodologies, and those have been approved by the permitting facility. And so they're right here. They're in the time where they're collecting their data for their environmental impact, socioeconomic impact, and they will be coming to us, the facilitated group, with their operating plan. We will review it as the TRT to make sure it's complete, and that will start the clock ticking on essentially a year-long process to move through reviewing that operating permit, getting the public input on operating permit, going back and making sure all the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted before we would issue. And we have a clock that ticks. We have essentially a year once they submit the operating permit and we decide that it's a complete submission. We have a year to evaluate that and give an up or down on the operation. Now, the final part of that is, at the end of it, of course, there is the opportunity to contest those findings in either direction. And that contested is also got a very short fuse. We only have 60 days where we have to take it through contested case, and from there it's remitted directly to the Supreme Court. So that is the two-minute overview in the consolidated mining permitting process.
Great job.
So, Randy, you want to
Randy, it's all yours.
Thank you, Chair Witt, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Randy Jones. I'm the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality's liaison to the Northeast and Greater Eastern Regional Solutions Center in La Grande. And so I'm responsible in my work for cities, counties, businesses in all 10 easternmost counties, Malheur being one of them. I'm the DEQ designated staff lead on the Calico project. I'm also the elected co-chair of the technical review team. And this is a regional priority project, as identified by the Regional Advisory Committee for the Regional Solutions Center. And so it's on our radar as a multi-agency team. And I'll talk more about the role of the Regional Solutions Center very briefly in a moment, but I thought I would give you a three-minute overview of where we've been and where we're going next. Calico has...
Andy, let me interrupt.
Yes, Chair.
On that 3 minutes, can you do a wrap on the whole thing?
Yes, I think I can.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for your help. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So Calico has progressed through the Oregon's chemical mining statutes further than any company yet. These were written in the early 1990s, and were written with a specific regard to chemical mining. So some heightened concern when you talk about hard rock mining at depth and or heap leach mining and processing and chemicals like cyanide. But Calico has made great progress. There's been 9 permitting and reviewing state agencies involved in the process to date, including the Department of Justice. The technical review team, the project coordinating committee have been meeting regularly with fully public settings and notice. We've had listening posts statewide through the process to date, and the clock really started in June of 2012 when we received a notice of intent. And so since that time, then, the largest body of work that the committees and the team has been working on is getting the company positioned to gain approval of a work plan that has all the required methodologies for a number of the different disciplines that you saw in the slide, so that work plan is approved. And it's a very technical document. It prescribes both methodologies, analytes, all the universe of measures that the public really would need to know when you're talking about chemical mining activities. That approval was gained in early March of this year. So that's the snapshot update of where the company is. They're in the process of collecting that baseline data. And so we have discovered, as a multi-agency team, some really valuable things, and I think among those is the value of interagency collaboration, and it really is actually happening. And so that has saved a fair amount of time. I know we don't move as fast as the private sector does. I spent most of my career in the private sector, so I really appreciate that fact. I know we don't move as fast as Calico would like us to. However, it's been robust. It has been thorough. We have found, we've shared ideas, we're finding solutions. We're expediting this review to every extent we can. We're planning for the future of this Calico project. So we've also worked very collaboratively with the applicant, and we've found the need logistically to make some adjustments to the approved work plan, and we need to be very careful with that, but we have an identified process to do so. And that's an important fact to also inform you of. So what's next? Out of the data collection phase, we think, based on what we know of where the company is right now, by the fourth quarter of 2014, they should be wrapping that effort up. By next spring, they would like to do a bulk sampling of the ore body itself. So we're working on that aspect as well to allow them to penetrate with a decline at depth to collect a large volume sample and prove up that finding. And then by the second or third quarter of 2014, we believe that Calico will likely be in the throes of assembling this large multi-agency consolidated permit application. They, as I said, we're working on a number of different permit summaries for the company to consider. There will be a number of permits issued under this consolidated application. And Malheur County is one of those efforts. So we do understand the county is making their primary permit effort right now is land use, to make sure that that is a, that's a pre-approved, if you will, by the time you get to that permit application. The I wanted to mention kind of a tag on to some of the work that Calico has been accomplishing through the Idaho College of Business. One of the efforts that the Regional Solutions Center has made in partnership with Eastern Oregon University is an internship program. So what we want to do is assist the company by providing, say, senior business students or MBA students the opportunity to assemble parts, maybe substantially, the socioeconomic analysis and give those students that opportunity for real-world work in their backyard for the kind of economic impact as well that is occurring in Eastern Oregon. So by the early 2016, I think that's kind of the magic window here. That's a target that I think the committee and the technical review team is looking at to allow a construction start. We want this to be a replicable process as well. You've seen the other potential mining targets. We understand there's additional interest in the mining industry in Oregon as a result of this very transparent process that we're managing. So we want this process to be well documented. We want it to be fully public, and we want it to be replicable. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I think I can speak comfortably for the majority of Oregonians that that's precisely what they want. Thank you very much for your presentation. Do we have any burning questions at this point? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much. We would love to see this project move forward at the highest level of performance that a mining operation has ever been done in our nation. Thank you all for your contributions. With that, Rick Sherman, can you do a presentation in 5 minutes? You're going to get an award today.
No, not necessary.
Welcome to our committee, and I apologize in advance for the
That's okay.
For the press.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm prepared to do just a really quick snapshot of the House Bill grant process that we just went through, and just and if you have any burning questions. We started last year in 2000.
And excuse me, folks, just for a moment, if we could keep the noise level down just a little bit, it would be helpful, and I apologize. Mr. Sherman's going to be speaking on a farm-to-school.
Right. Yeah, we had a farm-to-school grant. I started here 1 year ago, and we did the farm-to-school grant for $200,000, and
Rick,
we were able to roll
Rick,
that
would
out.
Rick, would you yes? give your name, please?
Oh, I didn't say that? No. Rick Sherman, sorry. Farm-to-school, school-garden coordinator
you.
With the Oregon Department of Education.
Sorry for the interruption.
No problem. Last year, the segue into this year's grant, though, we only had a short amount of time to spend the dollars of 4 months when typically fresh fruits and vegetables aren't available. And so the good thing about this grant, which we had a much greater influx of cash to the tune of $1.2 million after everything was said and done, but now it's a two-year purchasing framework where we have to work with where the school districts that were awarded are able to purchase money and for locally grown and processed food to reimburse their lunches with.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions you would like to
Thank you
ask
very
about this?
Much.
And you have basically everything, a snapshot of every school district that was awarded.
Wonderful. You, sir, get the award.
for our committee today, and I know that you went through a very fast presentation. It's greatly appreciated, and I just want you to know that I'm going to go back for the second year in a row to do kind of a tour of farm to school here later this fall. So
let us know, and I would be happy to bring that accompany you on that. And also, if you would have us come back maybe after a bit into this, and we could give you a report how the schools are doing, that would be fabulous too.
I think the committee would appreciate that very much. Are there questions or comments? Representative Whitson.
Yes. Representing Klamath and Lake Counties, we've been wondering down there when you might expand to our area.
Expand to other areas?
Yeah, down Klamath County.
Well, and as if we would have more school districts apply for the grant, that would be the thing. We had 30 school districts apply, in which we awarded 19, I believe. Okay. And many of them were on the I-5 corridor, and we had some in eastern Oregon, some a little bit everywhere, a couple on the coast, but it would be nice to get some more in southern Oregon as well.
Right.
And it's a great economic development opportunity. I mean, it's just tremendous. So maybe you could help with some suggestions of how to get that up and started.
Oh, you bet. Sure.
Thank you.
Super. Would be greatly appreciated. Yes, Representative Reardon.
I'm just not sure I have the handout that was mentioned.
It's on the OLIS system.
On OLIS. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Materials.
Toughest question I could come up with.
Anyone else? Thank you very, very much. Appreciate
Thank you.
That. And a question now for Ron Anglin. Can you do cormorants in a couple of minutes? A few minutes? Sure. 5 minutes.
All he needs to do is hand out a couple of recipes on how they might be used.
And again, my apologies to you as well in advance for moving you along so fast.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here today. We've got a handout coming around. The first portion of that handout is kind of a summary of some information that had been requested by Representative Whitsitt relative to Klamath County and Klamath Lake. Some of the work that's been ongoing down in that basin by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service relative to cormorant colony counts and predation studies. At this point in time, what the research has shown is that predation has not been a significant role in, or playing a significant role in, the loss of pit-tagged lost river or short-nosed suckers. But the work is ongoing down there, and we are going to be doing some more intensive monitoring as part of a statewide effort that I've reported on to the Normal House Ag Committee as part of the Pacific Flyway efforts. And I'd be happy, Representative Whitsitt, to meet with you in more detail on some of those discussions. The second piece is more of an annual update, and I guess the things that I would really like to focus in on is, I've reported to this committee in the past, we'd applied to be part of the National Depredation Permit. The Fish and Wildlife Service has made the determination they are not going to add any new states to that permit, and Oregon will be excluded from that. However, I am happy to say that the regional office of the Fish and Wildlife Service here out of Portland is in the process of laying out a year and a half to 2 year pathway forward for us that once completed should give all the states within the Pacific Flyway authority to more directly manage cormorants as they see fit, and should also give us the ability to go forward with population management objectives that we could determine for Oregon and the Oregon estuaries, and also for the lower Columbia River. prior or leading up to that final decision by the Fish and Wildlife Service, based on the information we've been collecting, we will be submitting a revised depredation permit for the Tillamook Estuary for 2014. And based on some initial conversations, we fully expect that we will be granted that. We're still collecting information on the Coquille and the Rogue. We have some preliminary results from the samples that we've done, but we won't really have the really good data on that until probably February of 2014. So when you come back this next winter, Chair Witt, if you'd like to have us come in, we should be able to provide you some more information at that point in time.
I'm sure we would very much appreciate that, but I want to make sure I heard you correctly. We think we're going to get permission to move forward with our own program?
Chair Witt, the meeting we had with Fish and Wildlife Service here about 3 weeks ago, we jointly worked out a process that we think within 2 years we will have that in place.
That is music to a lot of people's ears in this room right now. Thank you very much for that good news.
Well, it's really been a lot of hard work, Chair Witt, by our director, and working very closely with the director of the regional office here, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and her deputy, and keeping this on the front burner with the service, and really pushing hard for allowing for action to take place in Oregon.
Well, we certainly want to thank our federal partners, but also recognize that the ball wouldn't have moved without the state carrying it. So thank you very much for all of your efforts.
Not a problem. That concludes what I had, Chair Witt.
Thank you very much.
I'll bring you one for Christmas so you can post it.
Okay. We're going to, in February, we're going to have a cormorant recipe.
There you go, a cormorant recipe. But so I love it.
Everyone's doing yes, Representative Krieger.
The service says that the cormorants aren't significant eating the suckers in Klamath Lake. What are they eating?
Good point.
But other than suckers in Klamath Lake, planted trout, you really don't have anything.
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, there are a suite of other species in there within the Klamath Lake. Some of the breeding colony information that is included on the front page of what we've got here has shown that there has been some declines in the breeding colony. It appears to fluctuate. We're not 100% sure why, but the 17,000 pit tags that they've put out in the most recent research, and they've only, can't remember the exact number, they've only recovered, I think, 18 at the cormorant or the pelican colonies, which would indicate, which is typically where those would be expelled by the birds after they've been digested out of the fish, would indicate that the predation rate is pretty low at this point in time. But there are other fish species available there, and like I said, it's preliminary work, and it's still ongoing down there to determine if there is further impacts.
Representative Whitsitt.
Yeah, I just want to say that the handout that Fish and Wildlife gave to us this spring showed the second largest breeding colony of double-crested cormorants in North America in this area, and so Klamath Lake and the refuge area, and so it's really confusing what they're eating if they aren't eating the sucker fish. So, I mean, just based on the numbers. So, anyhow, thank you.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Ron, thank you very much.
Certainly.
Appreciate your helping keep us on time.
My pleasure.
All right. With that, I'm going to call forward Kurt Melcher, please, the importance of hunting and fishing to our state. Oh, and I have, you had some other folks you're going to bring up with you.
I got Roger Furman.
Okay, very good. Welcome to you both. Do you think you can do it in about 10 minutes? Because I'd like a couple minutes with the committee here. If you could do,
Chair Witt, we will certainly accomplish that in 10 minutes.
Perfect.
And I'll go ahead and get started now.
Okay.
And I just want to make a few brief introductory comments. Again, for the record, Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to come here today, Chair Witt, members of the committee. We were asked to come and talk about, at your request, about the importance of fishing and hunting to Oregonians. I asked Roger here. Roger Furman is the head of our Information and Education Division. It includes the full spectrum of hunter education, targeted marketing to anglers and hunters, as well as efforts at recruitment, retention, and reactivation of our constituent base, our licensed buying customers. I asked Roger to put together some information that really kind of shows a snapshot, understanding we didn't have a whole lot of time today and we have less now. Just showed a snapshot really of where we are in Oregon and all the important things that essentially hunters and anglers and these economies fund as it relates to fish and wildlife conservation in the state. As you all know, I think all too well, that is the lion's share of our funding for important conservation work in the state comes through license sales. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to hand it over to Roger. I don't have anything more to add here today unless there's questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Roger Furman, Information Education Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. In the interest of time, I'll speed through this. Just a couple of points that I would make. We all know the importance of hunting and fishing to us in terms of our values. It's part of what makes living here in Oregon so special, whether it's the time we spend teaching our kids to fish or the time we're out recreating with our friends and family, whether it's at elk camp or on the river. It's an important part of our life here in Oregon. But there's more to it than that. It's an important part of the economy. And I'll skip through this slide. In 2008, we worked with Travel Oregon on an economic study that tried to pin down the economic benefit of hunting, fishing, and wildlife viewing and shellfish in Oregon. In that study, we found that in terms of trip spending, the amount that people spent when they went out and recreated, they spent about $1 billion as they travel. In addition, they spent about another $1.5 billion on equipment. But for most of this, I'm going to focus on the travel portion of this. And I know the committee was focused on hunting and fishing, but I do want to call out this wildlife viewing portion because of the point that Kurt just made, which is that much of the benefit or much of the wildlife viewing that occurs in the state is a result of the investment that hunters and anglers have made over the years in habitat protection and in ongoing management of all species, regardless of whether they're hunted or fished. As part of this survey, we were able to ask people where they spent their money and how they spent their money. This is a breakout that shows where that money went, and you can see that much of it went into accommodations when they were at the site, whether it was a campground, a hotel, motel, a rented facility or not. Also spent at small businesses like restaurants and grocery stores and gas stations, not just in the area that they were recreated, but also along the way. So in effect, what that did is it transferred money out of some of our more urban areas, particularly on the western side of the state, to the eastern side of the state. We know from talking to our customers that they will travel hundreds of miles to go hunting and fishing. This slide represents a graphic representation of how that money travels out of the metropolitan areas into the rural areas. And what this does is it compares, it shows the percentage of all of the travel and tourism money spent in a county that is tied to hunting and fishing and shellfish and wildlife viewing. And you can see in those rural areas, it's a significant percentage of the travel in those counties. Now, this is in terms of percentage. The chart looks somewhat different if you look in total dollars, and you'd see that those coastal counties from Clatsop down to Lincoln and then across the center of the state to Lane and Deschutes County, that's where the total or the highest amount of money was spent, and that of course has to do with the amount of fishing and shellfish opportunities and all the other recreational opportunities in those counties. Again, it's a transfer of money from a rural area or into our rural areas and small businesses across the state. So what does that mean in terms of jobs? According to some work done by the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation, it's about 15,000 jobs in Oregon. And to put that into perspective, that's more than is employed by both Nike and Hewlett-Packard, which is about 11,500 people combined. It's more than $500 million in wages and salaries and about $100 million in state and local taxes. That's about enough to pay for the salary of about 1,700 police officers and patrol officers around the state. And that doesn't take into account some of the other economic benefit that we see when with working with our license vendors around the state. When hunting licenses, fishing licenses are on sale, it generates traffic into their stores, as well as some of the payments that we make to landowners for projects and restoration projects, lease payments and construction work, etc. It also doesn't take into account commercial fishing, which is also another big contributor, particularly on the coast. One report I saw from the Department of Employment indicated there were about 1,200 jobs just in the seafood processing industry alone. A significant amount of personal income generated as a result of commercial fishing in the state. A lot of it possible because of the work that our folks do in a cooperation with the industry. And the moving picture you see in the bottom is some work that was done on the pink shrimp fishery, which allows people to continue to fish go after pink shrimp, but reduces the bytake on non-target species like halibut, groundfish, and others. That became the first certified sustainable pink fishery or shrimp fishery in the world. We've talked about Diamond Lake before. The tremendous economic benefit from that particular project was about a $6 million project done with the help of many partners. According to some estimates by the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, it's a minimum of 51,000 fishing trips and about $5 million in spending each year. And that was before we were able to open it up for year-round fishing. I won't spend a lot of time talking about our hatcheries. You know the importance of them and how important they are to providing fishing opportunities throughout the state. The work that we do with travel and tourism, we do a lot of promotion of our hunting and fishing and wildlife viewing opportunities around the state. As Kurt said, almost all of that, or a significant portion of that, is funded by hunters and anglers. About half of our budget comes from hunting and fishing license sales and the federal taxes associated with that, collected on the excise tax on purchases of firearms, fishing equipment, ammunition, all the related equipment that is used for hunting and fishing. And with that, I will conclude. We know that hunting and fishing is important. I raced through a lot of information here. Would be glad to talk to you again in more detail about what we found in our report and other information that's out there. But we hear constantly from our constituents, about our customers, about how important hunting and fishing and wildlife viewing is in Oregon, not just in terms of the economy, but in their personal life as well. And with that, I'll conclude my presentation.
Very good. Thank you very much, I think it underscores the importance of this form of recreation, or forms of recreation, in our state. The $2.5 billion that you mentioned at the beginning of your presentation, I'm wondering if it would be possible to equate that to what maybe some of our largest companies or some of our industries contribute to our economy, so that we can kind of get a feel for where this lies in the contributions to our state's economy.
Sure. I don't have that information at hand, but we can look for some comparisons. I know I have seen that comparison before and can get that to you.
I think that would tell a real story very quickly. Yes.
Vice Chair Esquivel, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did I miss something, or was trapping in there?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, no, it was not included in this, although I believe those numbers on trapping is included in the participation levels or information from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We did not specifically call out trapping in our particular survey that we did. We focused on the four primary areas of hunting, fishing, wildlife viewing, and shellfish.
I would think that would bring in something, because, of course, you know, they buy equipment, they're utilizing fuel and a whole banana, plus they're selling a product that they get and in turn have a trickle down.
Correct.
Sure. Representative Witt, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel, we certainly have the economic value of trapping. For instance, our trapping activity is all well logged. We know what the economic value of those pelts that they sell annually are, and certainly we know that as those dollars go through the economy, there's multiplication factors that can get applied. We can follow up with that with you. We don't have it here with us today, but we certainly do have that.
That'd be great. That'd be
okay.
Good to have.
The whole committee may want that.
Yeah. Anyone else? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much, and we'll look forward to that additional information, because I think it's just going to underscore how important these contributions are to our state's economy.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And with that, committee members, I'd like to take just a couple minutes here to see if any of you have any thoughts, ideas, whatnot, on bills that might be committee bills coming up, because that timeline's going to be here before we know it. And if anyone has anything, it's not to say that, you know, we won't come up with an idea after this meeting. Please feel free to contact myself or Beth if something arises. But I wanted us to have an opportunity to briefly discuss anything that someone might have at this point. Representative Krieger.
I met with Brett Brownscombe this morning, and after we passed unanimously 3441, the research bill, and I had talked to this group, to the governor, we as a legislator in the state have an obligation to fund certain pieces of research that are extremely important to our salmon resource.
Yes.
So he is looking now about, we're putting somewhere in the neighborhood of $40-50 million into stream restoration through OWIP. Research is not one of the things that those dollars can be specifically allocated for, so we may need a bill that will allow us to designate research for salmon one of the uses of those lottery dollars that go to OWIP. And I know already from talking to people that supported the bill. I mean, you name them, CCA, steelheaders, everybody you can think of, I'm certain that they would also support that concept, realizing that from those investments we'll actually gain more than we would from stream restoration.
And so will you kind of check back with the folks that are involved to find out what specifics they need, and if you have any need for any kind of assistance, please feel free to contact Beth and let her know, so that we can...
Brett's supposed to get back to me. She can maybe check with him.
Okay.
The governor's been kind of busy on a couple of issues
the
last day or two. So he'll be talking to him, explain to him. I'm sure he would support funding research.
All right. Representative Reardon.
And I've mentioned to you the we want to have the hearing in November regarding bees and pesticides.
Yes.
and what have you.
Yes.
And I don't know what will come out of that, to be honest, but there's potential for something.
It certainly does.
When is our deadline?
It's after the November hearing.
Okay, good. So we'll have an opportunity then. Also, I know that our last round of hearings that we had kind of on the multi-species management plan specific to fisheries, that was a hot topic, continues to be a hot topic, and I'm not prepared to suggest legislation at this point, but I think it may be fertile ground for us to do something perhaps. And so anyone who has any input in that regard, our committee members, the public at large, if you would start feeding that to us, we could perhaps use that input in constructive ways. Okay?
We'll get that done.
Very good. Anyone else with any ideas? We've got some good ones that have come up. I think it's been a good conversation. I appreciate very much everyone staying here right through to the 5 o'clock hour.
Thank you.
Appreciate your...
It's a company that...
it's great company. And with that, I am going to, unless there's anything more for the good of the order, I'm going to adjourn the September 17, 2013 session of House Ag and Natural Resources. Thank you. Session of House Ag and Natural Resources. Thank you.